Detroit. Welcome to WRAF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan. Peter and Jolene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Jolene.
Thank you very much. Welcome. Hi, Jolene. You who can't hear yourself, well, talk in the microphone.
Are you on a delay?
Maybe. Well, I just don't know how to do this. Come here and play with the board, Jolene. I think we are broadcasting. Look, we are having a major technical difficulty here, folks. Hey, there you go.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, what went on here? Jade.
She's in trouble.
You left us in some weird mode. There we go. Still can't hear yourself, huh? Can you do it now? You can hear me, huh? Well, I'll just keep talking, figure out some way to do it all. All right, welcome to the broadcast. Technical difficulties notwithstanding, Jolene Jordan is going to try to find out why she can't be heard, and I don't know what in the world that sounded like. Anyway, thanks for joining us. Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan with you on Night Call. Doing this for a long time, and I'd like to have you be a part of it. Our numbers are 313-298-WRIF, and that translates into 313-298-9743. And Athena and Sarah, standing by to get your calls. We're open line always, which means you can bring up any subject you like, and boy, there's lots of them, isn't there? We've got a great Facebook page. Thanks, Jolene. She's really knocking it back with the page. Jolene is looking at this board, which, unless you know what you're doing, looks like the control panel for a 747. And you're just trying to figure out, let me see, all the buttons that are pushed on my mic are put. You want me to just keep going?
Yeah. Huh?
It's getting irritated at me.
I'm totally irritated.
Yeah.
Not at you.
Not at me. Okay. So we like Facebook likes, and we'd also like to hear your opinion on any of what's there. All right, keep going. Right. We'll have a podcast available of all of this by noon tomorrow, and thanks to Athena and Sarah, who always put that together. It sounds kind of lonely with just me. I've grown accustomed to your face.
I don't know what to tell you, Peter.
All right. Well, maybe we can share the mic or something like that. One of the things, also, I have a page of my own, peterwerby.com, W-E-R-B-E.com, and I forgot to put up the guests for tonight, which we'll hear at 1 a.m. Eastern Time, and that's really a shame, because there are two incredible interviews. One is with Tony D'Annunzio, and he's the director and producer of a film called Louder Than Love, The Grandy Ballroom Story. Now, some of you who are older may have gone to the Grandy Ballroom. That is a venue where everybody under the sun and during the late 60s and early 70s played. We were talking about Led Zeppelin and Cream and, I don't know, Chuck Berry, B.B. King, the MC5. I couldn't even begin to name all the bands without taking up a long time. And a lot of these people make appearances, The Who, make an appearance in terms of being interviewed and their memories and some films from that era as well. So that'll be at 1 a.m. tonight. And the film is being shown this Thursday at the Detroit Institute of Arts down by Wayne State University. The 7 o'clock show completely sold out. And the 9:30 show, I think there are still seats available. It'll then be in Ann Arbor at the Michigan Theater a little while later. Following that, Scott Martell, Detroit, a biography. And that's just the story of Detroit. And, you know, we all think, oh, I know about Detroit. I live here, right? And let's see, Cadillac, a guy named Cadillac, or was it Buick? No, it was Cadillac. Discovered the city in sometime or other, and then the Tigers won the World Series in 1968, or it's got to be some other stuff. Oh, yeah, that's right. They made cars, and we were the arsenal of democracy, and then what happened? Oh, yeah, Coleman Young got elected, and everything went to hell. I mean, that's the usual narrative, at least with everybody in the suburbs. So as you can imagine, it's a lot more complicated than that, and it's pretty interesting. So that's at 1:30 tonight. But like to get your calls at 313-298-WRIF. And the two big topics are continuing the slaying of Trayvon Martin by George Zimmerman. That is not going away. Huge demonstrations. There was one last Monday that I was at with a bunch of friends, and very moving indeed. And also that the Supreme Court is hearing constitutional challenges to Barack Obama's signature health plan. And I'd like to hear from you on what you think of both. Can we cook these two things up? Probably. I mean, one thing, it's a pretty crazy country. One of the things I was thinking about, Rick Santorum, who won't give up. I mean, although he definitely is not going to be the presidential campaign for the Republican Party, he and Mitt, and I guess, what's the other guy, Ron Paul, just will not throw in the towel. And I suspect that neither of them are going to, or none of them, rather, are going to get to be the vice presidential nominee. I mean, they trash talk Mitt so badly that he's not going to say, well, let's let bygones be bygones, because they would say to him, hey, look, you said he blah, 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 blah. You know, they're going to, you still believe that? What are they going to say? No, I changed my mind because I'm the running mate. So I think what they certainly are going to want to do is somebody that's going to pull key votes from important constituencies, and that would, I suspect, the Hispanic American community. So it'll be somebody like this far right wing senator from Florida, Rubio. But we'll see. And the rhetoric from these right wingers, well, it's typical of the right wing, you know, and it just gets more and more extreme. Romney, who in fact is a Massachusetts moderate, as Rick Santorum has called him, and has flip-flopped so that he echoes every single insane position of the far right wing that even 10 years ago was so far out of the mainstream that it makes George Bush look like a moderate. George Bush. Whatever happened to that guy? Who is he endorsing? Any luck?
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
You can?
Yeah.
I just have to do the show without headphones. This is really fun.
Oh, okay.
Hi, Peter.
Hi. Boy.
Wow.
Glad I'm not married to you.
What are you talking about? It's all about the show, Peter.
You just, that anger in her eyes. It was,
well, you know.
I don't blame you.
It's frustrating.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's got to be just one single little button to push.
There is, I'm sure. But, of course, it's late, and the engineers are all asleep. So I'm okay. I can do this because I am a professional.
Did you try to call Jade?
I tried to call everybody.
Okay. All right. We're back. Oh, so I was talking about how the right-wing rhetoric has gotten so extreme. But everybody knows that one of the things that Rick Santorum has said, and this is the guy that's against contraception. No, I didn't say abortion. Contraception, right?
Yeah, I mean, what century is this?
He is...
Even in cases of rape.
In cases of rape, he should see it as God's gift.
Oh.
You got one mean MF God if he's behind that.
Really?
Yeah. Here's your gift, and by someone who just smashed you in the face and ripped into you. Yeah.
Speaking of that, it's Palm Sunday. I mean, you and I don't celebrate it, but I thought it was pretty ironic that it's Palm Sunday and April Fool's Day. I don't know. Just saying.
There you go. Here is something, though. So here is one of crazy statements by Rick Santorum. You know what? I got to get up. I got to get my little. See, you threw me off. You scared me.
Are you afraid of me?
Yeah.
Give the call letters.
I don't blame you. But give the call letters. They know where we are.
Give the phone numbers.
All right. 313-298-9743. We do have open lines, and that's what this is a phone-in talk show. It's not just about us yapping.
There you go. But so Rick Santorum said Obamacare would destroy American freedom. I mean, it's a pretty wild statement.
I mean, I don't understand that, because what really it stands to do is save tens of thousands of lives.
Yeah, and actually save tens of billions of dollars,
right,
and extend health care. I mean, really, this Affordable Care Act pretty much sucks. And it was because of the Republicans, obstreperous? What's the word? Obstreperous? What's the word? Why? Okay, what did I do? I went for a big word and couldn't deliver. You know, they're roadblocking everything. Because what's really needed is single-payer universal health care. Oh, that sounds like socialism. Well, it is. And it's called the Veterans Administration. It's called Medicare.
Hey, how about we paid for Dick Cheney's heart?
Yeah.
That's socialism right there.
Absolutely. And all you have to do with Medicare, it starts at 65 now. Why don't we just start it at birth?
Why not?
Whoa, that's socialized medicine. How about 64? 63? You know what I'm saying? That's nuts. But here is Obamacare destroying American freedom. I wonder if the health care in Canada has destroyed freedom there, or the health care in England or Sweden or Denmark or
every
or
other
France.
Industrialized nation in the world that has a health care system, and we're the only ones who don't.
Here is what happened outside of San Francisco. Outside of St. Louis. Anna Brown wasn't leaving the emergency room quietly. She yelled from her wheelchair at St. Mary's Health Center security personnel and Richmond Heights police officers that her legs hurt so badly she couldn't stand. She'd already been to two other hospitals that week in September complaining of leg pain after spraining her ankle. This time she refused to leave. A police officer arrested Brown for trespassing. He wheeled her out in handcuffs after a doctor said she was healthy enough to be locked up. Brown was 29, a woman who had lost custody of two children, homeless, on Medicaid, and an autopsy later revealed dying from blood clots that started in her legs then lodged in her lungs. She told police she couldn't get out of the police car, so they dragged her by her arms into the station. They left her lying on the concrete floor of a jail cell, moaning and struggling to breathe. Just 15 minutes later, a jail worker found her cold to the touch. Officers suspected Brown was using drugs. Autopsy results showed she had no drugs in her system. 6 months later, family members still wonder how Brown's sprained ankle led to her death in police custody and whether anyone, including themselves, is to blame. Gee, do you think?
Man, that's a horrible story.
Speaking about doing an autopsy on a dead African-American woman, which she was, I don't think it says it in here, does everybody know that they did an autopsy on the body of Trayvon Martin to see whether he had drugs or alcohol in his system? They took this from a teenager. Oh, well, they must have done it to George Zimmerman, who shot him. No, they didn't.
No. They didn't do anything.
They didn't. So they don't know what was up with him. Well, here is the deal. It turns out, interestingly, and this is, I think, very telling. The majority of people in this country, when you ask them, do you support the overhaul of the system of health in this country, the Affordable Care Act, which has been called Obamacare, which is all right with me, 47% said they oppose the law, 36% approve. But what is interesting, great numbers of people appreciate the larger provisions of it, or maybe the smaller ones. Asked about a provision requiring insurance companies to cover people with a pre-existing medical condition, 85% said they approved of that element. So that part of the bill is good, and they would certainly support that. Because you got to remember, these healthcare companies aren't healthcare companies; they're banks, they're insurance companies. They want to pay out as little as possible. So if you had a pre-existing medical condition, yes, too bad. You just have to pay for it yourself, and that's why we're forced. Unlike
I've got you wrapped up in my headphone wire.
Wow, you can't imagine
how that went out.
People who can visualize that, but whatever.
I'm having issues. It's okay.
Yeah. You made me forget that. But what was I saying?
Sorry, Peter.
Yeah, 68% approved of the provision allowing children remain on their parents' policies till 26. So that means if this gets all overthrown, people, that means that, your kids aren't going to have, you're not going to be able to cover your kids. And what's happening, of course, is that in a way, childhood, that is staying with your parents in their home under their insurance and all that, is being extended longer and longer because pay is so bad for young people.
And jobs are so scarce.
And student debt is so high.
Right, exactly.
So before, kids would say, man, I want to get out of here. And as soon as I get my good job, as soon as I leave college, because I went to college for 4 years and I owe $800 to the college for my loan.
$800?
Well, this was back in the day.
Yeah.
But, now.
Now it's $40,000.
77% approved of a provision reducing the cost of prescription drugs for Medicare recipients. So they mean there's 23% of Americans who don't approve of reducing the cost of prescription drugs.
These people are absolutely nuts.
Yes, they are. Let's see. But here, this is interesting. the poll results echo some of the criticisms raised by Republicans on and off the campaign trail. Robert Foss, an independent, blah, 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 said in a follow-up interview, the whole way the law was brought about, the length of it, the scope of it, was a wrong step in the wrong direction. I believe forcing people to buy insurance is unconstitutional. It's taking away the choice people have. Well, here, a lot of people are going to say, well, you know, I don't want to buy insurance. I'm healthy. I read this guy who's 55 years old, mm-hmm. and he said, I don't want to be forced to pay $1,200 a month.
Right.
Because, you know, what is that? $14,000. Yeah, it's $14,000 a year. He says, I'm healthy. The only thing is, though, when he has to have a quadruple bypass, uh-huh. and then he can't pay it, that cost is socialized. That's one yeah. of the reasons. I mean, the main reason that we have the costs are so high is because of the nature of the for-profit medical system itself. But all those people that get treated, that then the hospitals have to treat them for free, and they do that, that becomes a socialized cost. So this is ultimately attempting to spread it in a fair way. Of course, the insurance companies make out like the bandits they are. But there's the aspect of it that is concerning people is, say, you know, they're going to give stipends to people. For instance, if you make, say it's 40 grand is the cutoff point. So if you make $39,999 yeah. a year, they'll help you, the government will help you get pay for the insurance.
Yeah. They'll offset
However,
the cost, right?
If you get if you make $40,001, you don't.
Right.
So you maybe say, look, I just can't afford $14,000 a year.
Yeah.
You know, because if you make $40,000, what do you go home with? I don't know, 30
yeah,
or
around there.
Something like that. And then 14, that leaves you 16. So the deal is this, you know, is what I always say about the two parties. What we have, what this Obamacare, the Affordable Medical
and Act. Obama owns that name. He likes the name, but the Republicans are trying to make it a negative thing.
Right.
Yeah.
So who doesn't have it? It's mostly young people, and I don't know. They figured, I make so little. I make $22,000 a year.
And me?
Yeah. Yeah. But here now, this is very important. Most Americans say they worry the law will raise their health expenses. Now, that is a realistic worry. I don't mean that inherent in that particular bill or the system that would come into place would in fact raise it, but it's a serious thing to consider. And
there are people on both sides of, you know, Democrats and Republicans who are concerned about it.
And a steady majority say they are somewhat or very concerned that it will limit access to care. And we know that, in fact, that there's a two-tier system, like everything here. Mm-hmm. If you've got great insurance and you have, or you have a lot of money, which usually go together, you get the best health care in the world. Below that, it starts to suck.
Like right, this woman
who died in a police cell with a blood clot because she couldn't convince him that something was wrong with it.
Terrible.
In addition, most agree with Republicans' contention that many businesses won't be able to afford to provide coverage to employees and will be forced to cut jobs, which could be. A lot of small businesses are working on a very thin margin.
Yeah.
So how do they do it in the rest of the world? Here we are, the wealthiest country
right.
in the world.
Well, they have a better system.
They do it in Canada. They do it in England. They do it in Italy. They do it in France.
Single payer.
They do it in Sweden.
Right?
Yeah. So I don't understand why all the big companies aren't behind this. But, you know, here I was...
Greed, Peter.
And I think that there has been the Republicans have been successful in instilling this fear of government.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, government as an institution, the political state since it arose, has 99% of the time been tyrannical.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the few incidences of democratic countries, I mean, truly democratic, are few and far between. But let's go back to that statement from Santorum. Obamacare would destroy American freedom. So this is an extreme charge. He doesn't say,
I mean,
you know,
no wonder people are freaked out.
Yeah. I mean, he doesn't say, you know, I'm worried that this may cause this.
He doesn't have the ability to be that sane.
You know, I read this article, which you would think has nothing to do with this. It's called The Spanish Holocaust by Paul Preston. And they're talking about Spain under the rule of Franco. This was this fascist revolt in 1936 that overthrew a democratically elected government after a horrible civil war. in which the fascists killed about 200,000 people by death squads, vigilantes, village rivals, firing squads. And then when Franco took power...
Sounds like Syria.
Yeah, in 1930. Well, that's very apt. And Franco, who was an ally of Mussolini and Hitler, in fact, had troops from both of them aiding him in his battle against the legitimate government. But it was smart enough to stay out of World War II. So he stayed in power from like 1939, I think, to 1974. But also that he prolonged his revenge, liquidating 20,000 opponents after the war, condemning hundreds of thousands to prison, exile, ostracism, or poverty, as Franco made a calculated investment in terror.
So what are you saying, Peter?
Is this all about? So this Preston says there are two main drivers behind the slaughter. Forget about the second one. That's about Spain's colonial army in Africa. He says the first... Now, this is talking about the fascists.
Okay.
The first was the absolute and often paranoid conviction of radical rightists that the enemy was evil. And they were Democrats, communists, Jews, Marxists, Muslims, free women, trade unionists, socialists, socially concerned priests, and social liberals. They were simply because of their beliefs considered to be guilty of crimes against the fatherland, God, and the natural social order.
That is so terrifying.
Does that sound familiar?
Yeah, it really does.
Is this where these conservatives are at? I mean, that's why when I say that they are...
Where did they come from?
Well, what fascism has always done, and fascism has always functioned in two things. One, it's always functioned in support of the big corporations. It's a defense mechanism against any assault on it by the left, but now there's no assault on corporations by the left. They're running supreme. And number two, which you, of course, remember what I was going to say, right?
Always.
it'll pop up to me. But this is, that they operate on the basis of fear. And there's great fear in the land today, and it's stoked. It's fear about race, and this gets back to the Trayvon Martin thing.
It gets back to the Obama thing. Stoked
by fear about even things like medical care. That suddenly in a period of economic precariousness that will have to pay more or that will get less medical care. And the Republicans are masters of whipping up this fascistic fear on people that can translate into these this stuff that eventually people wind up not even doing things that are in their best interest. What do I think about the health care bill? It sucks. There ought to be I don't want to give all this more money to the insurance companies. And why should somebody that's a dollar over the limit for stipends for that have to pay it? It should be, hey, tax the rich, cut the military budget, and we'll have this wonderful, wonderful land where we're not at each other's throats.
In this country, though, it just seems like the corporations just always win. They just really do rule, and that is what one of the things that needs to be
changed. It's the golden rule. He who has the gold rule.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. You know, I had a few more things to say. I'm interested, though, what Jason from Roseville has to say about the Trayvon Martin drug test. Jason, go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
I wanted to say the reason Trayvon Martin was drug tested, just like in any homicide, the victim is always drug tested. They do that on any case across the board. It's just not because of his race or anything like that.
I didn't think so.
I mean, but that was the implication that you were giving. Why would they drug test a black male instead of
why would they only drug test him and not George Zimmerman?
Don't you think it happens to be standard procedure to drug test perpetrators too, is it not?
No, I mean, because you can actually, by having the person alive, you can see if their eyes are dilated, you can see how they're acting. You can tell more if they're on drugs by the way they're acting. Is that not also true?
Hey, yes and no.
I got to say, the weed doesn't necessarily alter a person's personality like alcohol.
And usually when we talk about drugs, I go through this litany of people that I don't even know them anymore, that police officers, judges, prosecutors, doctors, dentists, all who did drugs on a regular basis.
And they,
go ahead.
Oh, you're there?
Yeah, so yeah, I'm here. So I'm just saying, no. I mean, the standard procedure was. Let me. You know what people have been saying. Do you think? Well, you know, neighborhood watch. One of the things you do, you go armed with a cell phone.
Peter and I are both in.
Yeah.
We both are kind of like block. We're like George Zimmerman.
Except we don't carry.
Kinder, gentler George Zimmerman.
We don't. Jesus, I don't like that. But we don't carry Kel-Tec 9mm semi-automatic, hoping they're going to find somebody.
Right.
And you can tell that by how many times George Zimmerman called 9/11. What was it, 46 times and what have you. So.
Yeah, well, he did that. It was more like 50 to 60 times that he did it in a year because he's constantly suspecting people of doing something.
So it was, Jason, it was pretty interesting. I think it was interesting information to learn that Trayvon Martin did not have drugs or alcohol in his system because he just came from his dad's house. Don't you think that was a good thing to know?
He didn't come from his dad's house. He came from his dad's girlfriend's house. That was the place where they were at.
Right.
Go ahead and interrupt me. I know it's true against one, and you guys don't let me get a word in.
Wait, first of all,
you're talking way too fast.
Yeah.
I couldn't understand one thing you just said.
Do you think it was good information to have to know that Trayvon Martin did not have drugs or alcohol in his system, don't you?
Yes.
Don't you think it would have been good to find out whether or not George Zimmerman had it in his system?
I would like to talk without being interrupted.
Well, that's
not how it works, dude. Okay.
All right. You got one more chance.
Go.
Do you think it would have been interesting to find out if George Zimmerman would have had drugs or alcohol in his system?
I think the police on the site could make that reference without drug testing.
Well, all right.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Thank you.
Wow.
Yeah. What about if they have a bad history of not arresting people that have assaulted black people, as the Sanford police have? All right. Thank you. Bye.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
I mean, I actually.
You know what? Let's go back to this. Okay. I was thinking, you know, there's been this full scale assault on the character of Trayvon Martin, this dead teenager.
Absolutely right.
And guess what? He got kicked out of school.
Oh no, he had a little bit of weed or something.
Yeah.
Like
no,
that.
Traces.
Traces. Yeah. Of yeah. It.
Wow.
Yeah. Which.
Yeah. I got kicked out of school.
Such a harmful.
Twice.
Harmful drug.
As a matter
you
of
did?
Fact. Yeah. Yeah.
I never did.
But here's according to this, Zimmerman said he was heading back to his car when Martin attacked him. His lawyer said that he felt one of them was going to die that night when he pulled the trigger. All right. Martin's girlfriend, who was on the phone with him in his final moments, told ABC News in an exclusive interview that she had not even been interviewed by the police. So there's a lot of sloppy police work here,
yeah.
Jason. Yeah,
absolutely sloppy.
Yeah, and in fact, one of the investigators immediately wanted to charge him, and he was overruled by the other cops. His girlfriend was on the phone with him. Yeah, well, and despite Martin telling her he was being followed, the 16-year-old girl recounted the final moments of her conversation with Martin before the line went dead. She said, "When he saw the man behind him again, he said, 'This man is going to do something to him.' And then he said, 'The man is still behind him.' And I said, 'Run.'" And actually, the phone records show that.
Yeah.
Dee Dee, the girl's name, said Martin turned around and asked Zimmerman why he was following him, which is the opposite of what Zimmerman claimed.
Thing.
And
mm-hmm.
we can't get any refutation of that because he killed Trayvon Martin.
Right.
So we only have to depend on, well, like his dad and his brother.
Oh, yeah, who's been giving these interviews.
Yeah. I mean, Hitler's brother would have said he's a nice guy.
That's so true.
Yeah. And the girlfriend heard Zimmerman saying, "What are you doing around here?"
Yeah, what are you doing in these parts?
And there's something that there's an unspoken word right there. What do you mean? This is, for one thing, this was an integrated gated community. A third of the community is African American. So you know what he was doing around here? None of George Zimmerman's goddamn business.
Right.
And if he would have kept his nose out of it, he wouldn't have been such a nutball. If he wasn't carrying a killer weapon, none of this would have been happening.
And you could just see the insanity in his eyes.
And she said she heard someone pushed into the grass before the call was dropped.
Mm.
Now let's say that let's try to make the best case for George Zimmerman if we can.
We'll try.
Okay. For some reason, this all happened. I mean, this is all so maybe Trayvon Martin totally loses it, right? He's being confronted by this huge man, 250 pounds.
Yeah.
He's 140, and he smacks him in the face. I mean, it's possible. I don't think it's very probable.
Right.
But anything's possible, right? And why that since Trayvon Martin was frightened and told his girlfriend he was frightened. Why suddenly becomes this enormous aggressor and breaks his nose? I mean, when he gets taken into the police station later, there's no blood on Zimmerman's shirt. You can't see a cut on his head or anything
right.
like that. And then wildly begins slamming his head. And there's only one thing he can do: shoot him with his Kel-Tec.
Yeah,
right?
When he's such a big guy, he could have just knocked him down.
Now, the other thing that strikes me that we haven't heard about: what about at what range did he shoot him? If you shoot somebody very close, there's powder burns. I don't know, there's a more technical term for it.
Right. And there's, I mean, this is gross, but there's some kind of a certain spray, blood spray and things
yeah.
like that.
So, I don't know. You know, here's something interesting. Bruce Springsteen, who has this new album out called Wrecking Ball.
Uh-huh.
And he's going to be at the Palace on April 12th doing a national tour. He has added the song 41 Shots.
Has he really, to his set list?
Yeah. If you go to Bruce Springsteen's website, he sang it in Tampa a couple nights ago. There's an incredible 8.5-minute version of it.
Wow.
And here's what struck me about it. This was about the killing by New York City police of Amadou Diallo in 1999. He was an unarmed man that made the mistake of reaching for his wallet when he saw the police.
Yeah.
And he was shot 41 times.
Wasn't this the one the night before his wedding? Or
no, that was somebody else.
One,
no,
yeah.
That is Sean. That's Sean Bell, and that just happened in 2006. He was shot. He died in a hail of 50 police bullets in New York City night before his wedding, and he, of course, was unarmed as well. So the whole, it's sort of 41 shots, and here is some of the lyrics to it. 41 shots. Lena gets her son ready for school. She says, "Now on these streets, Charles, you've got to understand the rules. Promise me, if an officer stops you, you'll always be polite. Never run away, and promise Mama, you'll never keep your hands in your pockets. You'll keep your hands in sight."
Right.
Not in your pocket.
No, yeah, outside of your pockets. Correct.
This, according, and some of maybe our African-American listeners can verify this, this is what every black family tells their kids.
It's so awful.
Yeah. And you know how many white parents tell their kids that? Probably hovering around zero.
Yeah, like I would imagine.
And friends of ours, a white couple, have adopted a black child who's going to be 13.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
And I said to him today, I was just walking with him today, and I said, did you tell your son that? And he said, yeah, you're damn right I did.
Did he really?
Guess what? The kid wears a hoodie sometimes.
Yeah.
Of course, so do I.
Yep, so do I.
Yeah, yeah. There's an interesting article in one of my favorite websites, which is called counterpunch.org. Counterpunch.org, run by the, American citizen. Now, the
it's
feisty.
A great site.
Yeah, yeah. And his, I don't know why this. Come on, we're cooperate here, please. And it's on my website as well, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. And it's called, if I can ever get up to him, "Do You Really Think the Killers of Trayvon Martin and Those 16 Afghan Villagers Will Ever Do Time?" He says, "I'd say the chances of George Zimmerman spending time behind bars for killing Trayvon Martin are about the same as Sergeant Robert Bales doing time for killing those 16 Afghan villagers the night of March 11th. Zero."
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. We got to do a quick spot and or a couple of quick. Those are that's radio talk for ads. I think we just got two of them. So hang on. And Dave and Michael will get you right when we come back. There's more open lines. And I'd like to hear what you have to say, both on the Trayvon Martin case and also about Obamacare, too. And what will it mean to you if it goes away? And can you believe there may be some good news about student debt?
Good news.
Tell you about what students are doing.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werbe and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Here are Peter and Jolene.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. Talking about the Trayvon Martin case, also about the challenge to Obamacare, whether you think it ought to stay or go. I think it ought to go and be replaced by single-payer universal health care. Take Medicare and just start it from birth.
And so that's not until June, right? the decision.
Yeah, they're going to make it. They're, apparently, they're voting on it now. But Scott is listening in Stockholm, Sweden, and he writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Trayvon Martin's shooting regarding gun regulation and violence. He said he sends in this chart, pretty interesting. Note the difference between homicides and suicide, which show that in countries like mine, being Sweden, where most guns are for hunting, homicides with guns are very rare and less than a tenth of the suicides, and both are much lower than the U.S. Also, look at the company the U.S. keeps at the top of the table. The supposed developed U.S. is nestled in with Latin American states with recent and current revolutions and drug wars. So, interestingly, at the top is South Africa, but Colombia, El Salvador, Jamaica, Honduras, Guatemala, Swaziland, Thailand, Brazil, Estonia, Panama, Mexico, and then the United States. And then you got to find, you got to go way down to find Finland. That's really weird.
But, yeah, that is very weird.
But anyway, one of the things that struck me. So the United States has per 100,000 about 10 and well, let's just call it 10. 10 firearm deaths. Per 100,000, which is pretty high. And, but, get this, there in Mexico, for instance, there's 10 homicides per 100,000. In the United States, there's 4 homicides per 100,000 and almost 6 suicides.
So
per 100,000. The point being is that one of the major uses of firearms in this country is not killing each other, but killing ourselves.
Oh, geez.
More of us kill ourselves and kill other people, if I'm reading these statistics right. And, okay. Let's
too
go.
Too many guns!
Let's go to our phones. Here is Michael in Fenton. Hi, Michael. You're on the air. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air.
How you guys doing?
We're doing good.
Hi,
what's
Michael.
Up?
Hey, I wanted to talk about that Obamacare, but a couple comments first is that I believe that Mr. Zimmerman murdered that kid, and I don't think he'll get away with it. You know, it will come out, and there's no way he's going to get away with killing that kid.
Well,
I hope not.
Here's my prediction, Michael. He will be brought to trial. He'll be indicted for manslaughter or maybe on federal civil rights charges, and he will be found not guilty. And can you say Rodney King? Remember what happened after
the riots.
I agree with you that it will go that way because of the system and the jury will let him go. He didn't get away with it. He ended up in jail.
Well, it took a long time. That was a travesty of justice. Hey, tell me about Obamacare.
Okay, Clinton tried to get the care, and Obama's trying to do it. It's not going to work because Santorum's right about what he says. We're going to lose our freedoms, and what he's talking about is his side of the deal with the Republicans. If they allow that to go on, the people with the money that run the insurance companies or whatever, they're going to lose them freedoms to make all that money, and they're never going to let that happen. So we're not going to ever see medical care in this country like what we should have because we got these thieves stealing the money and making all the money, and they're going to keep that going, and how are we going to stop them?
Well,
sense.
Well, you know, at some point, and I'll talk about that in terms of the way students are finally beginning to organize against this huge student debt that they're being saddled with. Yeah, as long as we just allow other people to decide our fate. But as I always say, there's been huge movements in this country to change history, beginning with the Revolutionary War and through, the abolitionists and the union movement and the suffragettes and all these movements for rights. And it's people that said, I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore. And we keep taking it. Because, you know, they could still make a fortune. This 1%. This 1%, even if we took half of all their money and used it for making this place where there wasn't poverty and we had great first responders and terrific health care and weren't involved in wars all the time, they would still have a fortune. Because in all these countries like Canada and Sweden and Denmark, that are much more like that. For one thing, there is freedom, and secondly, the rich guy still has a lot of money. But people don't have to worry about whether they're going to have health care, or they don't have to worry about whether they're going to get mugged, or they don't have to worry about, you know, 100 other things that comes because even though this is the wealthiest country in the world, it's all lodged up with the 1%. Michael, thanks for calling. Appreciate it. I appreciate it very much.
Yes.
Here is John. John's in Warren. John, hi, you're on the air. What do you think about Obamacare?
What do I think about it? Yeah. Well, let me tell you, first off, I have a wife who has stage 4 cancer, has less than 6 months to live. Under the current system, if I lose my job where I'm at now, my wife dies quicker than 6 months because I won't have the health insurance to protect her.
Right.
That is awful.
The second point is that the majority of Americans don't have a clue. They don't even know. I've gone up to people at my job and said, can you tell me anything about the Affordable Care Act?
Right.
They don't even know what you're talking about.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
But if I say Obamacare, they'll say, oh, that's socialism. He doesn't have a clue what he's doing, blah, blah, blah. Like the last caller, Santorum is right. Santorum hasn't been right on one thing since he's been involved in this campaign to run for presidency. I'm 58 years old. I'm in a union. I want to retire at 62. Under our current union contract, we don't have health care when we retire. Under the Affordable Care Act, I'll be able to purchase health care at the rate of what my income is at age 62. So government subsidies will help me purchase that insurance for my family, for myself, and if my wife was alive, to cover her. So any American that tells me that the Affordable Care Act, I call it that. I don't prefer to call it Obamacare.
Well, because they've turned it into such a negative thing.
But anybody that tells me that it's bad, I bring up my situation, and I have not had one person. They don't know what to say.
Well, I can only imagine. What do you say to that, right?
Yeah.
You know, stop them in their tracks.
Then I say, well, under the Affordable Care Act, I would have insurance. I won't lose my insurance. I'll still have insurance, and I'll be able to pay for it with credits from the government to help me purchase it. So the American people, as far as I'm concerned, and I hate to be negative, but they're stupid. They don't know anything. All they know is what they hear off of Fox News, right-wing radio, and, you know, whatever they hear from the grapevine for the people that they're working with.
Well, let me tell you this, John. The number of Americans that actually listen to right-wing talk radio or to Fox is actually a fairly limited percentage of the American people.
So explain why.
But what has happened, they're able to, you know, to foist these Republican talking points into the mainstream. So if you really, as it sounds like you're doing very righteously, asking people for a little detail on the statement they make, well, you know, they don't have anything to say. All right, John, it's a, you know, and one of the things that happens, too, you know, that very frequently I do public service announcements on these stations here for people that are having like a bowling night for somebody with a serious illness.
Yeah.
If they were 8 miles, 9 miles away from here, they wouldn't do it because they'd be living in Windsor and they would Canada, and they would just be able to get that. Go to the doctor and get the care they need as a matter of right as a citizen. All right, John.
So sorry.
Yeah. All right. Thank you for joining us. 313-298-WRIF.
That just pisses me off,
too. Well, one of the things is, and take John's challenge, which, you know, he was saying that the people that oppose the Affordable Care Act, or I don't even care about calling it Obamacare, because one of the things that often you can do is take a negative and kind of own it.
Yeah.
And then you change
it. It's like the gay community, queer. And, owning a lot of, I mean, I know a lot of lesbians who own the name Dyke,
right?
Where most people are like, she's a dyke, you know, and so, yeah.
Yeah. All right. Let's see some open lines for you as well. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Dave in Harrison Township. Hi, Dave. You're on the air. Dave.
Dave, turn your radio down or off.
Back off.
Is it me?
Yeah,
it's you,
Dave.
Man.
Dave, do you want to talk to us?
Yes, I would love to.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Go.
Now, ready?
Yeah. Right.
One, two, three, go.
Three, two, one, go.
Hey, three, two, one, go. Hey, great. Hey, thanks for having me on.
Sure, go ahead.
I'm a Detroit fireman.
Oh, okay.
The whole thing is the whole Trayvon thing is a horrible travesty. Of course, it's a tragedy. I was actually in Florida when this whole thing went down. I was on vacation, and I feel the black and white tension now. You know, just in Detroit, my thing is.
Well, wait a minute. I went to a rally. In Hart Plaza.
There was no tension.
Calling for justice for Trayvon Martin. And unfortunately, and I say this because there should have been more people from what we call the white community, which I don't ever say that I am part of. I'm part
we
of the community.
Resigned.
Yeah, I'm part of the community. And it was probably 85% African American, and there wasn't the slightest bit of attention. Except, you know, I didn't tell you this, Jalene. A man in his like mid-40s came up to me and he said, "Could I ask you a question?" And I said, "Yeah, of course." I mean, I thought maybe he was going to ask me for money or something. And he said, "Why are you here? He said, "Well, you're European. Why are you here?"
You're a what?
European.
European?
Yeah, I mean, he meant white. And I said, "Because I believe in justice." And this big broad smile came out over his face, and he said, "Thank you." So there was no tension.
That's interesting.
Yeah, yeah.
What is the justice for those two girls they just unearthed the other day, though? Because you know, in Detroit, it's a black on black crime seems to be okay.
Well, wait a minute. What in the world are you talking
what
about?
What does
Dave?
That mean?
Wait a minute. You're a Detroit fireman, and you're saying something that ridiculous? I mean, listen here. Every right-wing talk show I listen to, they're saying, yeah, but black people count black people.
White people just can't help themselves.
Yeah,
I swear to God.
I know. It's like Tourette's. You know
it
what Tourette's?
Really is.
Yeah.
It's like racial Tourette's, Peter.
If you would avail yourself of maybe living in the city that you protect as a fireman, that maybe you would get more of an understanding of the people that whose homes depend on you. At this rally that, of course, you were safely ensconced out in Harrison Township, that if you would have listened to the speakers there, their concern greatly was with two things. One was justice for Trayvon Martin and also the level of violence that happens in Detroit. The leaders of the black community of Detroit, from the mayor on down, from the church leaders and of every faith, talk about that. And you know why that happens? Because this is the way poor communities operate. You go to any poor, because one of the things, when I gave that list of all of these countries that had, except for the United States, that had high murder rates, they're all really poor. It goes with the territory.
Sure does.
Yeah, that's where crime comes from. You want to keep a class of people, and a class, not a race, because there's poor whites and poor blacks and poor browns. They're going to commit crimes disproportionately to your nice middle class people, regardless of their race. It's all about poverty. And if we want to have a country in which we have a 1% running everything, and eventually it's going to be a 1/3. It's going to be a third of us are going to be live okay. We're going to live in these gated communities. And the other 2/3, it's going to be like Kingston, Jamaica. Right? That has a very, very, very high murder rate.
Yeah.
So the idea that this, you know, that I look at these right-wing websites and they say, eight black teenagers with hoodies attacked whoever. That doesn't have anything to do with it. It's to be expected. On the other hand, there are so many resources within the African American community in Detroit that are pouring their hearts out trying to stop this violence. But you know what? I hate to say it. As long as there's poverty, as long as people feel so defeated, as long as people feel so angry, as long as they feel so worthless, they're going to keep preying on their neighbors. I've lived in predominantly black neighborhoods, and I've always said this, probably 96, 97, 98% of the people were the most wonderful neighbors and what have you. Have 2% of the population, which it maybe could be something like that, involved in crime, it's hell. So get on the clue bus, man. You know, don't call me with that crap. Should I tell them what I really think?
Yeah, it was white people. That's all I have to say.
What is the woman, the co-host of the Howard Stern show, Robin Quivers?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and you often don't realize that she's African American until you go. So if you want to see whether Jolene is black or white,
do you remember when we went to Santa Cruz, California, and there was a woman who came to meet us, and she thought I was African American. She really did.
Because of your name.
Well, she said it wasn't even just my name.
Yeah, I mean, because we usually get, you know, us Europeans got names like Wirchikovsky and stuff like that. You know? Yeah. Sometimes Smith and Holly, but, you know.
Right.
Right.
That was a first.
Yeah. Well, you know, Johnny Otis was,
uh-huh.
The guy wrote, man, I almost had the biggest slip of the tongue that would have had us laughing.
I'm so glad you didn't. No.
It's going to start here.
Don't do it.
Without it.
Don't do it.
Okay, all right, I won't say what it was. Anyway.
Oh,
he was, a white musician who lived black, and he said he was white only by... What a mishap of birth.
I love it.
Yeah, he, a great blues musician, DJ. God, he had everything. He was everything.
That's great.
All right, let's see. 313-298-WRIF. You know, don't let me, if you got dumb ideas in your head, don't let me turn you away from calling. You know, I'm willing to make you look like a fool publicly. This is not encouraging people to call.
No, it's not, Peter.
Yeah, I don't give up.
As your producer, I say,
all right,
you're fine.
Here's David in Canton. David, hi, it's Peter and Jolene. You're on the air.
Oh, hey, how you guys doing?
We're doing good.
Hi, David.
Good. Listen, last week I was able to catch the end part of your show.
Yeah?
It ended too soon for me. I was laying there in bed, and I clicked on the radio, and I caught the last about 10 minutes.
Doesn't it always end too soon, I tell you? Couldn't you just listen to us all night long?
Go ahead.
Well, tonight I decided to kick you guys on a little bit early.
Good idea.
I was driving down Cherry Hill there, and I was able to hear Jolene say something that was quite, I guess it's questionable.
And I wanted to,
I need you to clarify.
Hit me.
First of all, are you atheist?
Yes.
Okay. I assumed that.
So is Peter.
Great.
And proud, a proud atheist at that, by the way.
Okay. Let it be that.
Yes, I will.
But I want to understand how, well, I need to get.
Okay.
I'm kind of confused.
Let me help you. Let me help you, brother.
Okay, cool. At what point is it okay for you to equate Palm Sunday with
I just said
April Fool's?
All I said was that it's April Fool's and it's Palm Sunday.
Well, what he's saying is...
That's all.
What he's saying, people generally think it's rude to insult other people's strong beliefs. I mean, you can do it about political beliefs. You can do it about personal beliefs, but people don't like it. You know,
we do it all the time.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean, listen, we're just probably digging ourselves a hotter enclave in hell, right?
No, but the thing is, I mean, I personally feel in this country that it, as the Christians say, this is a Christian country, and that's what they're writing on their signs and going to all these rallies right now. I feel like religion is totally shoved down my throat. For a very small percentage of citizens in the United States, we are atheists. What is it, Peter? 1% or something like that?
Oh, much more than that.
Yeah.
Hey, but let me...
I feel like it's freedom of speech. I should be able to say that if I want, David. Don't you agree?
I agree that you should, but I don't think that you would say anything like that if you were referring to a Jewish or a Muslim religion. Jolene, be fair.
Well, you know what?
What?
You know what? Well, we would certainly tell a Jewish caller or a Muslim caller or anybody else the same thing of our beliefs.
Yeah.
But in terms of making fun of it, Jews and Muslims are a minority, and they're often made fun of in a disparaging manner that winds up in discrimination and hurtfulness. As Jolene just said, I mean, Christians are dominant in this country. And if you look a lot at, you know, the culture, and everything from movies to songs to poetry and everything like that, Christianity is often attacked, or mostly, you know, and also Christians, particularly for hypocrisy. I mean, there is a TV series on called Good Christian, what's the word?
I don't know, but your wife keeps telling me about it. GCB something.
GCB, yeah. But the book came, and I guess I can say the book. It came from a book called Good Christian Bitches.
Okay.
But they obviously weren't going to put that on
mainstream
the
TV,
telly.
Right?
Yeah, and that's all about hypocrisy. So I don't know. You know what? I don't understand why in religions, if God is almighty, all-powerful, omnipotent, and omniscient, and I mean, there's a song about him. He knows when you are sleeping.
That's Santa Claus, Peter. I keep trying to
Are you
to
sure?
Tell you.
Okay. I mean, why should he care about a couple of human pipsqueaks making fun of him?
You're listening to Nightfall with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
Thanks for listening to 101 WRIF on the World Wide Web at WRIF.com.
April and the D on Fox Sports Detroit. Tune in all month long as Fox Sports Detroit brings you live Tigers, Red Wings, and Pistons games. Next up, the Pistons battle the Magic. Coverage begins Tuesday at 7. April and the D continues on Fox Sports Detroit. WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
You're listening to Night Call, the list award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
All right, 313-298-WRIF. I'll do it for you. Are you ready?
313-298-9743.
Now, that was the stage announcement that, I want to hear some revolution out there. That was the stage announcements at the Grandy Ballroom back in 1968, a live recording with the MC5, and that was Reverend...
Were you there?
Jesse Crawford. Yeah, I was in my mom's arms. And we, in an hour, going to be airing an interview I did earlier with Tony D'Annunzio. Tony is the director and producer of a documentary about the Grandy Ballroom, where all the greats of the late 60s and early 70s
played. Hendrix,
yeah.
You can go on and on.
Louder Than Love, it's called the Grandy Ballroom Story. It's showing at the DIA, the Detroit Institute of Arts,
cool.
This coming Thursday, 9:30 is the only showing.
I want to go.
Oh.
But I can't. It's too late.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, I could get you a date.
Who are you going to get me a date with?
he works right over there in the afternoons.
No.
Okay. Let's continue on here. And here's Kevin in Detroit. Kevin, hi. It's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for calling the show.
How you doing, Pete?
We're good.
All right. I'm the guy who stopped you and asked you at the rally down in Hyatt Plaza. I wanted to go, and if I knew who you were, I would have been offering my hand in friendship, because I've enjoyed listening to you for 25 years.
That's great.
Well, thanks.
I mean, you and Jolene. I don't think Jolene's been with you for 25 years.
I've been with them for 14 years.
I was holding her in my arms.
You're right, but like I said, I think you're tops. I just think
I
enjoy you immensely. And I'm a black guy, and I'm like I said, I've been listening to you for 25 years. And the thing, what a caller said a couple of callers ago, blacks don't care for black-on-black crime. I beg to differ, because I think there are churches and organizations in the city of Detroit who try to address those issues.
Yep.
You know, and I think that he's totally off base with that.
Well, I think it's a typical example of white people not being able to see out of their own whiteness. I mean, how can they even form any kind of opinion when they haven't spent any time? Like, go to, of these black neighborhoods.
Well, he has, though. That
and
guy
see
was,
how it is.
He said he was a Detroit
fireman. Oh, he
was the
firefighter.
Yeah, I mean, that's...
Well, he's not paying attention.
You know, the worst thing that ever happened to cities in Michigan, and I kind of understand, how the courts decided, but there used to be what they called a residency rule, and which meant that cities could compel people that they hired to live within their city. The idea was that if we're paying you, hey, you ought to live here.
Yeah.
And for one thing, Detroit on the east side was an extraordinarily safe area because all the Detroit cops live there.
Yeah.
But right now, Jalene and I live in a suburb in separate homes. And I don't know what they, you know, with cutbacks, I don't know what we're down to. But of all the police, not a single police officer lives there.
In our city.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. So it would be an excellent thing if employees could be compelled, I hate to say it.
Yeah.
And if they don't like it, I would always say maybe they should get a job where they live.
Like after that, like saying the situation that happened in Littleton, Colorado, when a white kid shot up the school. I mean, you can say that's white on white crime. I mean, this kid.
That's a really good point. That's a really good point, and no one will ever say that though.
You know what, though? But wait, Kevin, you know, one of the things, I don't even like that phrase, white on white or black on black.
Yeah, that's true.
Because what we're talking about here is not whether or not black people are shooting black people or black people are shooting white people or the reverse or anything like that. We're talking about the discriminatory practices of a municipality who's one thing. Their police are almost out of control in Sanford, Florida. In New York, they're completely out of control. Mm, yeah. You can see the way they, you know, how many unarmed people they've killed. They just killed an unarmed 18-year-old, just this last week in New York. And, you know, how they've acted around the Occupy Wall Street and what have you. I mean, they actually all live in the city, too.
Yeah.
But they desperately need some control and discipline, which they don't have from the top, to be sure. But what we're talking about here is not the racial component of who hurts who, but rather why in the world in such an obvious situation that they would just let a killer walk away, do a drug test on a corpse of this poor young teenager, whatever happened. Because you got to remember, if George Zimmerman would have been, you know, they said he was a neighborhood captain. Yeah, I wonder who the hell appointed him neighborhood captain.
He appointed himself.
Self-appointed. And I was watching local news, and they were interviewing a neighborhood watch groups in Detroit, and They said, first off, you don't go out by yourself. Secondly, you don't go out armed. What you do is you have a cell phone, and when you see somebody, but he wanted trouble. Because I'll tell you, if I go out and, you know, I'm not really out in neighborhood watch, but I have a cell phone with me when I walk along. I've never seen any crime, so it's not real good. But if it would occur to me, if I saw somebody breaking into a house, I would duck behind a tree. And I would say, hey, 911, you get right over here to my street because someone's breaking in. I'm not going to go
confront the guy or gal. Right?
Yeah, with my big pistol that I just have a... What's a nice word that I'm just all jacked up to use?
Right.
Right. All right, Kevin. Thank you very much.
Go ahead.
What?
The other thing you said about the singer you said that played blues music, even B.B. King said that. Stevie Ray Vaughan said that, you know, like he was he made the comment that he was a black man trapped in a white body. He's a Stevie Ray Vaughan.
There you go. B.B. King, by the way, is in this film about the Grandy Ballroom. But I haven't seen the film. They offered to let me see a screener, an advanced copy of it. And I said, I didn't want to look at a minute of it. I want to see it on Thursday night on the big screen. And B.B. King was, man's 84 years old. He's still playing the blues, still touring. But he kept referring, and Kevin, if you go back far enough, you may remember this. He kept referring to the Grandy Ballroom as the 20 grand. Which was where all the Motown acts, or a lot of them, played. All right, Kevin, thanks for joining us. 313-298-WRIF. Let me get on to this just in a minute. It's Nick and Steve. Hold on. 313-298-WRIF. I wanted to get this in because remember I was saying last week that the student loan debt now tops $1 trillion. So you students, people that have graduated, owe $1 trillion to the 1%. Because you just think, it's the government. But the government is, you know, doing this. They're not, it's a long story. Anyway, So it's essentially the rich loaning money to middle and working class people that want to follow the American dream.
Improve their lives.
But they're being hobbled because when they get out of college, they owe 10 grand, 20 grand, 30 grand,
yeah.
40 grand,
yeah.
something like that. I told that story through, and I want to tell the whole story again. I came out of college with a lot of money through a lawsuit. And I mean, I can't begin to tell you that.
It wasn't a lot.
Well, for then, it was. now it's what I got in my pocket. To come out of college with that kind of debt is just amazing.
Yeah. So, well, you know, I'm in school right now. I'm racking it up pretty good.
Yeah. Student protest debt as student loan debt collectors make a billion. 36 students were arrested at the headquarters of the student loan provider, Sallie Mae. It's not someone's name, is what they call the institution.
Right.
Dozens of students were arrested this afternoon at the Sallie Mae headquarters demanding forgiveness of student loans. Blow them all off. Screw those rich people. You know, what is more important for young people who are starting out in life, in marriages and in careers, maybe not even finding a job, to owe $30,000 or $40,000, or some rich SOB that's going to have another million? Screw them. That's what I say.
Tell us how you really feel.
Yeah. The high amount of debt is good news for debt collectors, however. A Bloomberg report shows that debt collectors made nearly $1 billion in commission from aggressively pursuing student loan collection efforts. Oh, my God.
Yeah. It's terrible.
Here's where people in other countries, for instance, and our neighbors to the north, although people that know the geography of Detroit know that actually Windsor is to our south. Check
that's
them out.
That's in Canada.
Yeah, that's in Canada, right. But they, and who has socialized medicine and mm-hmm. haven't lost their freedom, they announced in Quebec that they were going to have tuition increases. So you know what they did? They said, oh, darn. Oh, no. I'm reading this wrong. That's what they said here. And they turned out 300,000 students and supporters
yeah.
that said, we're mad as hell and we're not going to take it
That's
anymore.
That's what happens in London all the time.
200,000 people in Montreal alone. So this is a model.
Wow.
I mean, unless you're willing to swallow everything that the 1% puts out for you, do something. And if you're thinking, I don't know, I'd like to, but I don't know what to do. Hey, you know, Thomas Jefferson and Patrick Henry and the rest of them figured it out. The abolitionists figured it out. The suffragettes figured it out.
Yeah.
Walter Ruther and the Union movement figured it out. Martin Luther King and the rest of them figured it out. Gay movement and women's movement figured it out.
Yeah.
And unless you want to come out of there with $30,000 or $40,000 a year, it's up to you. I mean, I can't do it for you. If I could say, I'm going to lead the student
revolution,
the jubilee, which means the forgiving of debt. If I could do it, I would. I'd be there tomorrow. I can't do it. You got to do it.
Hey, Canada. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Canada also is getting rid of the penny.
And we ought to get rid of the penny.
I so agree.
Anybody think
penny
we ought
is such a little menace.
Well, it's a menace, and it really makes. I wonder how many accounting errors.
Due to the penny. Yeah.
All right.
Little random thought there.
Let's get some people on the air. 313-298-WRIF. Here's Nick in Pinckney. Go ahead. You're on the air.
How you guys doing?
Good. Hi, Nick. How are you?
Hi. I've called before.
Great.
You guys. How you guys doing? I love you guys.
Welcome back. Thank you.
I just wanted to plug something real quick, if
sure.
that was cool. I lived in Ann Arbor for years and years, and I lost my job because of pretty much the economy and everything. I moved my stuff in with my folks, and I've been staying here for about a year now. And I'm in Pinckney. I've had a lot of friends in the past pass away because of drug abuse and particularly heroin.
Wow.
And apparently it's a big deal. Like I've been staying in Pinckney, I've been talking to some old friends, stuff like that, and a little high school kid that I've known like his whole life, you know, I'm 32, he's like 17, you know, I've known his whole life, you know, he grew up across the street from my parents,
yeah.
He runs over across the street and he says, we're having this big rally at the Jane Tesh Theater right on M36 and, you know, Pinckney, pretty much that's the high school I went to. And he's like, you know, I've had several friends pass away in the past 2 years. You know, he's got...
From the heroin?
Friends.
So they're having...
Yeah.
So what's the rally for? Against heroin?
Yeah, exactly. It's an epidemic in this small town.
Well, you know what's happening, too, Nick? Methamphetamine, of course, is the big one in the rural areas. And that, what happens when there's this level of desperation where, you know, and people take in, even if they have the idea that this was all caused by the greed of the 1%, the self-perception of oneself as worthy is hard to hang on to if you don't have a job and things like, you know, this is infantilization. You know, you got to go back and live with mom and dad. You thought you were an adult, and suddenly you're back under the. And I'm not being critical of you in the slightest. This is a mass phenomenon.
Yes, it is.
And also, if you owe $40,000 in debt, and they said, okay, hey, you've had 9 years of school. We got a great job for you. We just fired some 57-year-old who's making $57,000.
We're going to pay you a quarter of what...
you're 22, and we're going to pay you $22,000.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Called 22-22. And, you know, it's not going to work out very well. So tell me quickly, what's the you got a date and place and all that? You said the theater?
Yeah, well, to be completely honest, I found a great job, and I make plenty of money right now. I'm looking for a place.
Oh, well, good.
I'm doing well.
Well, that's nothing to be ashamed. That's being happy.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? When you said that, you had this joy in your voice.
Yeah.
So that's exactly the opposite. Was you weren't feeling very good, were you?
Well, I mean, yeah, it was like a bummer, but like, you know, I just had to stay with my folks for a minute. No big deal.
Okay.
You know? I mean,
Nick, tell me about the rally. Yeah.
The rally. Okay, so it's they even made a commercial about it and everything on Google.
When is it?
Tell me about the rally.
When is the rally?
It's on Thursday night at 7:00 p.m. on M36 at the Jane Tesh Theater, which is the old Pinckney High School.
Okay.
And I encourage everybody to go. My sister-in-law, pretty much, she was a victim of the same thing. And
well, I think there's an added impetus to go. Yeah, I mean, it is.
I'm always surprised to hear that. I don't know why, but, you know.
Yeah.
When I was in high school, everyone was just
smoking weed.
Yeah, dirt weed.
All right. Yeah. Nick, thanks for that information. I hope a lot of people turn out for it. Yeah. They're just
so sorry.
Used to be Michigan Green, right? That was the big one,
mm-hmm.
which didn't do much for you. Sorry.
I just gave you a headache.
Here's Steve in Woodhaven. Steve, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Yeah, I just was listening to you guys talk about that guy down in Florida and how he was able to just walk away. And part of the reason is the self-defense laws are different from state to state.
Right.
Down there, when I was down there for a while, it was all over the newspapers. The 76-year-old woman shot a man trying to break into her house before he even got in the front door.
This
up here, though, if they're not in your house, you're the criminal.
Well, I you know, it's called the castle defense.
Well, there's the stand your ground.
And now this is the others are stand your ground. And, yeah, there's actually in Wisconsin, there's a case where a bunch of kids were fooling around, late teens, and they were running away from each other. And this kid popped onto this porch, not into the house. Guy came out and shot him to death, and they said, "Boop, castle defense,
man.
It's okay." You know?
Yeah, but up here they will still try to go after you for it. And in fact, I could try to break into your house, get injured, and sue you.
Well, I'm not sure you're right. In Michigan, there is a stand your ground law that all the right wing gun nuts will probably be surprised was signed by Governor Jennifer Granholm, who's on my website. Wearing a hoodie.
Yes.
All right. Thanks for that. I appreciate it. 313-298-WRI.
Just a couple of open lines,
yeah.
If you want to call.
You haven't been reading any email, have you?
No, I have not been reading any emails.
Okay. Here, we'll get Ben and Westland on the air. Hi, Ben. You're on the air. Ben, are you with us?
Ben.
Yes.
There you are.
Good. You're on the air.
Welcome.
Go ahead.
Yes. I'd like to ask you one question. You know, Canada law, you got to wait like maybe 1 or 2 years before you can even get any kind of surgery done.
Where'd you hear that?
Where'd you get that?
What made you think that?
Well, with the Obama. Well, I know people who live in Canada. They got to wait 2 years before they even get any kind of surgery done whatsoever.
I'm asking you, I had never heard that before, and I think it's incorrect. I'm asking you, what's your source for that?
Well, the source is I know a couple people who live in Canada, and they had to wait 2 years before they can even get surgery done.
You know, why don't we do this, Ben? Why don't we ask? Why don't we ask our Canadian listeners
yes.
to tell whether that's true? You know, what
I'd like to have one Canadian person tell me their experience, Peter, because we have a lot of people who call in from time to time and say this to us.
Well,
and
you know what?
If they come over, Peter. You know, they come over here to Michigan to get their health care.
You know, it's not to say there's no problem with Canada's health system or a lot of the countries, because almost all the countries in the world. Which is pretty weird because there's trillions of dollars of wealth that there's not that any of these countries are having problems. Like I was just reading that France's vaunted social safety net is beginning to fray.
Yeah.
But here's what I think. One of the things that happens, Ben, is that under this conservative prime minister, Canada is spending more and more of its money on naval warships, on fighter planes. Why in the hell should Canada even have an army at all? And if they are having problems, what they need to do is to have spend less on military, which they don't need, and much more on serving their citizens. And to the extent that there are flaws in any of these socialized systems throughout the world, nobody would give it up. I mean, the conservative prime minister is not going to he would no way in the world would he ever say we ought to end socialized medicine in Canada.
That says so
the
much.
The conservative prime minister of Britain would never, who was doing all these cutbacks, would never. Well, they are doing a few cutbacks in medical stuff, and the S is hitting the fan.
Yeah.
But the number of people here, they estimate that at least 44,000 people a year die because of lack of medical care here. Most of the medical care that anybody that doesn't have a decent income sucks. If you're middle class, if you're get up there below, you know, above the 66th percentile, you're getting the best medical care in the world. You start going down deeper and deeper and deeper. And the medical care gets worse and worse. The medical care in the United States is the best in the world. It, of the industrialized countries, it's the worst medical system.
Correct. Yeah. We have the technology, but
let's get some Canadians on the air. And there are Canadians, you know, listen, I mean, anybody who is here in the United States, if I said, hey, tell me about bad experiences you've had in U.S. hospitals or going to a U.S. doctor or trying to get treatment, it would be forever. And I'm sure there's probably people that, that have complaints about the Canadian system. But if they have complaints, it could be solved with money that they're using wrongly.
Well, all right, thanks, and I just can't see the key word, Peter, is system. Every system is going to have some kind of flaws.
Yeah.
Sorry. But it's true.
I mean, what was the Michael Moore movie? All of a sudden I'm forgetting about healthcare. Somebody remind us.
I hate when you do that to me.
Yeah. By the way, Nick called back to say thanks again for taking him on the air and letting him plug the heroin awareness rally. And he says he loves you guys. Ha ha. Did he say ha ha, Athena or Sarah? Or are you saying ha ha? This is a little message board here. All right. Let's see. Here is Steve. Steve's in Shelby Township. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter, Jillian. How are you guys doing tonight?
We're doing good.
Good.
Thanks for
Hi,
joining
Steve.
Us.
Good. Just wanted to go back to the Trayvon Martin thing for
sure.
a minute. You know, I heard you bring up the whole toxicology thing. Now, if I'm not mistaken, I believe every coroner post-mortem has to run a toxicology report on somebody who dies of other than natural causes. So that would have nothing to do with racial profiling.
No, well, I didn't say it did. I thought the discrepancy was it's also standard that when you have somebody who kills somebody, you might want to know whether they're impaired or not as well, right? So it would have made some sense to,
don't misunderstand me because I believe the Zimmerman guy, you know, Mr. Neighborhood Watch Captain, you know, he should have already been in jail.
I did not make my comment on that was the comparison, the fact that they would do an autopsy, a toxicology report on
Trayvon Martin
and not on George Zimmerman.
Yeah, they barely even questioned the guy.
And the first, I think they did. So I'm not sure.
Not enough.
Well, but what was I going to say? But the first guy was saying that it was the police at the moment's call, and you can tell when someone is high on drugs. Well, you know, when I'm a little buzzed on booze, I can still go 10987654321. Can I do it?
You're lightweight.
Yeah. Yeah, you know.
You're a cheap date.
And I don't want to even say that I'm using any illegal substance. I just do the drug of despair. Booze.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
right.
Which is by far the most horrible drug out of all of them. I work in the medical field, and I would rather take care of an ER full of cocaine heads and heroin addicts and meth heads all night long rather than take care of one drunk. Because drunk people can just be absolutely horrible. And again, alcohol is, by my opinion, is the scourge of our society.
Well, sure. Of drug abusers, combined. Well, that's
more readily available because it's legal for starters.
The prohibition movement from the 1880s, maybe even the 1870s, through when they passed the constitutional amendment forbidding the production of alcohol was the largest social movement that's ever occurred. I mean, you could have put all the other movements that I mentioned, the
civil rights, women's labor,
everything, and it wouldn't even have come close to how widespread the prohibition.
Really, I never knew that. So people just wanted their drink on.
Yeah, well, it was really seen. That thing is that drink is the scourge of the working class, whereas we think that work is the scourge of the drinking class.
I love it.
But and really, what it was, I mean, some of it was exaggerated, some of it wasn't. That men, working men and poor men, just spent enormous amounts of money in bars. They were men only. And it often led to violence against their families, to the women and children, and it somehow just grabbed people. But it is a great driver of violence and miscalculation, like thinking thinking, God, this kid just hit me. If he hit him, I'm not saying he did.
Yeah.
But say that Trayvon Martin hit him. I got to waste this MF because I've got this Caltech semi-automatic.
Might as well use it.
Yeah, I didn't bring it for nothing.
Right.
Yeah. Whereas when you listen to the 911 tapes of Trayvon Martin, a guy that has a history of violence, was arrested for attacking the police, who had a PPO out against him by his fiance. And
yes,
I think they even come to a third one who carries a pistol in a situation where it's absolutely unneeded and no other watch group that's not crazy, carries one, goes out by himself, and the language that he uses, these a-holes always get away.
Yeah.
So he's angry. He sees a kid. He sees a kid. And he said, I think he's on drugs,
I mean, how do you just assume that? The kid was allegedly just walking along.
He was black. That's what
That's right.
Yeah. And what are you doing around here? Says George Zimmerman.
Even though it's an integrated community.
Integrated community. All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Let's see. Some more calls. Here is Gilbert. Gilbert, hi. You're on the air. Where are you calling from?
Detroit.
Go ahead, Gilbert. You're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, Peter. First time I hear you on the radio, man. I've never listened to you before.
Okay. Good.
Welcome.
Welcome.
Yeah. I could talk to you for the rest of the night.
Please make it short.
We could talk to you the rest of the night, but we don't have that long.
You touch a lot of major points there that is missing from the media, from the news media.
Yes.
We fill in the gaps. Yeah, go ahead.
If we take a look at even how much did it cost us to go to Iraq and fight that war down there?
About $3
trillion. Yep.
And counting.
And how many lives?
Lives.
Yeah.
And nobody been arrested for it.
No.
Well, George Bush and Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, they should all be in, go to the world court.
They walked off with their $1 million and gone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And all their buddies made a whole lot of money.
All the contractors. Yeah. It was.
Well, I used to be a service tech in the air conditioning business in Maryland.
Uh huh.
And one morning we have a rain there and a little bit of snow. And I slid and hit just top of another car. So I have to call in about it to my company. And right away, I have to go and take a drug test before I could come back to the office.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yes. So it's interesting to see that guy shoot that young man, and they never even requested to find out whether he was on drugs or not.
And he shot and killed him, and all you did was fall.
You know, wow. I do have to move on a little bit. It says what you wanted to talk about was the Stanford healthcare. What is that?
No, I said the Stanford incident and the healthcare.
Oh, I see.
Stanford, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, Stanford.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. We're good. We're good.
Okay. I thought this was some system I didn't know about.
Right. It's funny how we Obama is trying to create something that we need as a people, and yet the people doesn't understand what he's trying to do. It doesn't matter if it was Obama or somebody else.
Right.
Well, it's what I said earlier.
It's even worse because it's Obama.
Yeah,
anyway.
I don't know if you caught it, Gilbert, but I was saying earlier that most of the people that opposed it expressed these fears that it was going to cost them more money.
Yeah.
That they were going to get inadequate care. That it was going to be rationed. You know, you had people like that nutball Sarah Palin going around talking about death panels and all that. And it, you know, it was something new. You know, when Social Security came in, when Medicare came in, the same people, the same Republicans were saying it was socialism. Well, it is. You know, it socializes costs, just like the police are socialism, the fire department is socialism, and, you know, the road commission is socialism. The post office isn't. It should be. But so people are fearful. And if they said, you know what, if they just said to them, hey, We got Medicare, works pretty good, maybe ought to do a little better. We got Veterans Administration, works pretty good, could, you know, some problems. But we're going to extend that to everybody. We'll have Medicare beginning when you're born. People will go, oh, I know, Grandma's on that. That, you know, she gets all her...
her medication.
Yeah.
All of her everything.
And now under Obamacare, it's going to cost them even less. All right, Gilbert, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Okay, here we asked for somebody from Canada to call about that oft-heard complaint by Americans that you have to wait years. I mean, if you got a ruptured appendix, they say,
they will take you in.
Here's Brad from Windsor. Brad, thanks for making our show international. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning to you.
Hi.
Hi.
Hi. So, number one, that guy who called in and said, you know, I know a couple of people in Canada.
Thank you.
That wait 2 years. Not the case. If you need emergency surgery, it happens. If it can be elective, it happens. People just don't wait years and years for things to happen.
Yeah.
That's so untrue.
Thank you for straightening that out.
I can't.
Because it drives me crazy.
But, Brad, I can't believe this.
Trust me, it drives me crazy.
Yeah.
But Brad, you know what that is, and that he was speaking what I was just saying, those fears that people have.
Right.
But hey, is it a 100% perfect system?
No, not at all.
Okay. What do you, where are its failings?
Well, you know, the thing is nothing is a perfect system.
Right.
I don't think we have a perfect system. I don't think that any public system, whether you're in Britain, France, or whatever, I don't think that's a perfect system. I don't think you guys have a perfect system. You know, there's people that fall through the cracks, but those are few and far between. But in general, we give good health care. It's there when you need it. You walk in, you put your card on the table, you get yourself done, you get yourself checked up, and that's the way it works, and it's worked just fine.
What do you think about, and Canadians usually don't like this, when I say that Harper and Canada in general is just wasting its money on these weapons of war, like warships to patrol the open waters of the Arctic when it's becoming free, that the only country that'll ever, well, at least in the short run, the only country that's ever going to attack you is, I'm calling from that country.
Right, exactly. Repeatedly.
Wow. Okay, number one, Harper's a clown. I did not vote for him, and he finally got his majority after a 5-year minority. So he finally got
in. This is in the parliament, folks, they're talking about. And Harper, which if you asked Americans who's the prime minister of Canada, you'd be lucky if you got 10%.
They wouldn't know.
Muldoon.
They wouldn't know.
Yeah, do you know that?
But
let me just Ronald Reagan, he referred to the prime minister when he was in as Prime Minister Mulroney, but he called him Muldoon.
Oh God!
Well, we talk about Reagan, right?
Yeah. That explains a lot, right there. Yeah.
Yeah. But no, I don't. Harper is not a government, and he will actually destroy this country because he wants to be a Republican.
Yeah.
He loves Republican governments, and that's who he wants to model himself after. And now that he's actually has a majority and he's putting through all this legislation, there's a lot of people that here in this country that are saying, wow, this is going to be a bad thing. We have probably 4 more years of him before we can call an election.
Wow. So I have just a quick question. So how is it having universal health care for you? I mean, is it perfect? What?
No, well,
it's not perfect.
Yeah, but you know what? No one in Canada is worrying about health care.
You're not. Yeah, that must feel good.
You know what? I mean, I talk to people that when they tell me what they pay a month for, like, themselves and their wife, they're self-employed or something like that, I'm horrified.
That's astounding.
I mean, they wind up paying $14,000, $16,000 a year to provide health care for themselves.
Well, see, we don't obviously pay in, we don't pay directly for it. We pay indirectly through our taxes. And obviously we have a higher tax system because we don't have that many people here in this country. But in general, it works. Our average, I think for 2011, I think the whole bill for health care in the country of Canada was approximately $210 billion.
Mm-hmm.
So it does, they are concerned about the cost, and there has been some issues about trying to privatize certain aspects of it. But in general, it runs just fine. If you need something, it's there.
Well, here in the U.S., if we just quit spending all of our money on illegal wars, we could afford that, couldn't we?
Yeah, and the reason that people object to taxes here, we don't get anything. Imagine paying the taxes we do. And getting a health care system, of having good roads, of not having 40 kids in school, of having free college the way it should be rather than having to pay.
Yeah.
And on like that. Well, hey, Brad, thank you. You're very helpful. I appreciate it. Thanks for making our show international, as I said. Okay.
Thanks
bye-bye.
A lot.
You have a good evening. Now, could we find someone that that would say, I tried to, and I went into a, and after, of course. Any bureaucratic system, and all modern systems have flaws and are bureaucratic by their very nature.
Yep.
Okay. There is a rematch coming up.
What?
With one of our least favorite public personalities, Sarah Palin. We'll talk about that when we come back.
Yeah.
Fred, we'll get your call. Jim as well. Some open lines at 313-298-WRIF. Oh, thank you very much. The movie we were talking about by Michael Moore is Sicko.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
So quickly we forget.
Check it out.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Oh,
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan.
All right, thank you, and welcome back to our final segment. So get in on it if you'd like to make a comment. Mostly talking about Trayvon Martin and also about the Health Care Reform Act, Affordable Care Act, sometimes known as Obamacare. At 1 a.m., Louder Than Love, the Grandy Ballroom Story, an interview with director and producer Tony D'Annunzio, and it's playing at the, oh, I forgot to mention a little part of this, too.
It's at the playing, DIA.
Yeah, at the Detroit Institute of Arts, only show left, 9:30 this coming Thursday, but there's also kind of a meet and greet at the Majestic.
Yeah.
Theater?
On Woodward.
Yeah, right. Thanks to Jay and Alex for also reminding us that it was sicko what we were trying to...
I don't know. Yeah.
That's worth seeing.
Yeah, really is.
You had an email you wanted to read?
I do, but you erased it.
Oh. you know, I did, but
you
I...
You did.
Yeah, but you know what? We have this...
It's gone.
It's not even... Oh, yeah, here it is. From Chad, writing to Call Talk, yes, at...
Yahoo.com.
Yeah, I'm reading it. Sorry.
I'm little, here for you.
Yeah, little. What would I, how did I used to do this show by myself?
I don't know. I wonder that all the time.
Yeah, a little confused, says Chad, how Zimmerman even had the red light to own a gun. When I applied for mine in Michigan, if you have a PPO, a personal protection order, out on you, you are red flagged by the county and denied.
And he had one.
Well, yeah, but I wonder now, Chad, because the National Rifle Association that just wants to have this country steeped in blood by just giving guns to everybody. I just saw this, by the way, and I couldn't find it again. This list of the hundreds of people that have been killed by legal gun owners and police shot and
everything. You mean in?
Other states, yeah.
Okay. This year? Or?
Yeah, this year.
Okay.
All right, here's the big rematch. Sarah Palin, remember her?
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Must we?
Did,
what?
She is going to be on this morning with Kathy Couric, who's sitting in for
That's
Robin.
That's Katie Couric. Katie Couric.
What did I say?
Kathy.
Yeah, I'm looking right at it. K-A-T-I-E.
It's all right, Peter. See?
I got it. Got to have you.
You need me, baby.
It's going to be on GMA on Good Morning America. And it's a rematch because you may remember.
Oh, yeah, because Katie Couric interviewed her and
was throwing her softball questions.
And what
Sarah,
magazines do you read? And what newspaper? She couldn't even answer it.
Well, all of them, Katie.
Oh, yeah, right. Like me, that, and you know what that meant, Peter?
None of them.
None of them.
Right. And here it says, asked for a comment about the fact she'll be will be competing with Couric. Governor Palin responded simply, game on.
Oh, please. Good. I'm looking forward to it. I'm not going to watch it, but I'll read about it.
It didn't do well for her the last time
around. No. She is so stupid. Oh, my gosh.
I don't know if you... You know, you haven't seen Game Change.
No.
The biopic
the
about on
about
HBO.
About Palin.
About Palin. And it is... You almost get feeling uncomfortable because this woman is so...
I do want to see it. You said I could come over and watch it.
You know what, though? You can. You know what? There... At some level, there is. It's not a crime to be uninformed. It's a crime to be misinformed. But it's no crime to be uninformed. You just said, I'm not going to do that. Well, you know, you shouldn't. A, you shouldn't offer up opinions.
If you don't.
I'm liking this. You're taking off your clothing?
I aim to please.
Yeah,
on the Peter Werby, Julie Jordan Night Call Show.
We need a webcam in here.
There used to be one.
Yeah,
they
really?
Took them down.
Yeah.
I don't know, roasting.
But anyway. But one of the things you might expect from people that want to determine public policy, that they would know a little something.
A little something would be beautiful.
But don't you think that Sarah Palin, since she's going back with
Katie Couric,
is going to memorize some publications?
I think she is, but you know what?
You betcha.
Katie Couric is going to go after her again. I just know it. I hope so.
I wonder.
Bring her down. Take her down, Katie.
We'll bring her down from where?
From that planet Uranus up there.
Here's Jim in Dearborn Heights. Jim, hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, hello.
Hi, Jim.
Hey, I got a question. You know, I agree. The healthcare system, something has to be done. It can't go on the way it is.
Seriously,
fine. And it won't either, but go ahead.
Right. So, and you know, that fellow Brad from Canada, he was very informative.
Yeah.
And I appreciated things he said. But, like, the question I had on my mind, like, over in Canada, they pay no premium. Everything is taxed to pay for the health care, correct?
Yeah, that's what he was telling us.
A lot of taxes, yeah.
Yeah, so, like, here, what happens when the clock ticks over January 1st of 2004?
14.
What happens if a person decides, well, I don't have the money for health care, I'm going to hold off until something catastrophic hits me?
You mean that's what people do now?
Yeah.
Well, people do that now, and then the costs, say that they incur like $30,000 in hospital costs, and then they can't pay it, and then the cost the hospital amortizes it throughout their other costs, so we wind up all paying it. So we're paying right now for the uninsured for the health care they do get, but the people usually only go at crisis periods. Well, no, I think this is kind of nuts that people. I think it's going to create hardships on the people that probably need it the most. I mean, I could be wrong, but like I said, if you're at the lower tier of that and you're not going to get subsidies for it. Well, and there is some penalties. There have to be penalties to it. And something wrong when you file your income tax. I don't know.
Well, I just...
But that's why...
I'd like to have health insurance. I'm looking forward to it.
All right.
If it happens.
Thank you very much. We're going to go through some of these quickly because...
TikTok, the show is going to end in about...
Here's Phil in Detroit. Phil, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, hi. I would like to relate a story on Canadian health care.
Yeah.
I was in Rochester, Minnesota, attending a conference at the IBM facility there, but I met a Canadian who was there specifically to have knee replacement done at Mayo Clinic.
Yeah.
And his story was that he had retired, but he had bad knees, and his doctor had been telling him for years in Canada that he would need knee replacement, so he decided to go in, and he was... filled out all the forms, et cetera, and was told it will be somewhere between 5 and 7 years before you can have both your knees replaced. And when he inquired why, he said, well, it's not an emergency. If you had been carried in on a stretcher or wheeled in a wheelchair, then it would have been deemed as urgent. You would have been moved to the front of the list.
I got to tell you, Phil, these are the same kind
we
of
anecdotal
things. You know, I always hear from Americans that somehow don't want everybody to have health care through the government, that Canadians have such a bad time of it. And then when you talk to most Canadians, I mean, like I say, you'll get complaints from Canadians. It's a bureaucratic system.
There's always some kind of flaw.
But the American system is bureaucratic of trying to go to, you know, all of a sudden you wind up, all of a sudden I got a bill for $700. And then you spend the next 6 months on the phone with them trying to get rid of it. But in the main, every industrialized country in the world other than the United States have it. Millions and millions of people don't have any health care whatsoever. They only go to the doctor or to medical facilities when it's an emergency. Tens of thousands of people die in this country, die needlessly because they don't have access to medical care. So the healthcare system here sucks. Do they have great care? Yeah. And I could imagine, I mean, people come here from Saudi Arabia. Or people go to other countries. Hugo Chavez went to Cuba to get cancer treatment, rather than and the Venezuelans would say, how come we couldn't stay here and get it? You know, but
healthcare is more advanced.
There is not a single conservative politician in the Western world that would dare to try to take away the socialized medicine from the countries in which they live. And they're conservative. This, Harper, the Prime Minister of Canada, of Great Britain, none of them would dare to take it away. I mean, the people would go crazy. People expect it as a right of citizenship, and well, that it should.
Absolutely.
But the only people you hear these stories from are Americans.
All right. It's amazing.
Thank you, Phil. And I don't know what to say. I mean, I don't think he's lying, that Phil. I mean, maybe someone did, but no one, you don't have to wait 7 years. Any more Canadians want to tell us about that? Why would you have to? Here's Patrick in Westland. Patrick, hi, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. I was actually calling about the Trayvon situation.
Sure.
Yeah.
I just kind of think that I guess I'm kind of sick of hearing about it a little bit, because I kind of feel like if the races were reversed, most of us would have never heard about it.
Sure.
And I just kind of feel like it seemingly is, like, every time something like this happens, it always initially is a race issue, and I don't think it ever really had anything to do with race rather than just protection of somebody's property.
Well, what do you mean you'd never hear about if it was reversed? Because if it would have been an armed black man that killed a white teenager, the armed black man would be in jail. And he would be facing probably murder charges, first-degree murder, so there would be nothing about it. I mean, why do you think that this has hit such a sensitive nerve among the black population? When you, for instance, there's this big stop and frisk thing in New York, and they started,
the pot thing, right? The pot arrests?
And all of the African-American and all of the Hispanic councilmen and state representatives, every one of them had this story, how they were just jacked up by the New York cops and just slammed against walls, had their pockets ripped open, on and on and on. I mean, these are our fellow citizens, and you got to have some confidence in them. If they're at the level of what would you call it, of indignation, of proper indignation, you know, there's something going on there. And it's like I say, for instance, here's another little thing. You know, this U.S., this federal judge in Michigan just acquitted these members of the Houthari militia, saying, oh, they were just talking. Can you imagine, here were these guys that were, you know, talking, they were armed to the teeth, and they were talking about, according to the government, taking out cops, and then when they had a funeral for the cop, firing on the funeral. And they said, oh, well, it's protected under the First Amendment. How long do you think a militia made up of African Americans or left-wing people would last, huh?
That goes to say, just like years ago with the David Koresh situation, I didn't see too many African Americans in there, but yet I seen the FBI burn a building down and kill everybody in it.
Well, I'll tell you what, that is one of the best arguments for not having guns. Guns are a police magnet. That when you start forming groups like that, you know, people always, you know, like now there's everybody's buying a gun. Why? Because Obama's a gun grabber. Well, he hasn't grabbed.
He's actually made things better for the gun, folks.
Yeah, he didn't renew like the semi-automatic assault rifle thing. He hasn't done anything, and he's not going to do anything.
Right.
But these people that say, like these militias and the Koresh people, they're doing, you know, to use a phrase from Detroit, Koresh and them sold wolf tickets, and the FBI bought them all up. They brought it on themselves. They were horrible. I thought what happened there was horrible. They never should have attacked the place. And it was, a travesty. But when you start arming yourself, there's nothing but trouble. I mean, you can go through the NRA magazine. You can always see, you know, somebody, you know, was able to protect their home or whatever. But when you start measuring it out in terms of the harm that people does, and what we find out, that the more people die from self-inflicted suicide than they do from murders in this country, and then you have this NRA that Jolene read this thing about the... Did you read that about the guy with the PPO? Did we read that on the air about the guy that had said he had the PPO and he was denied? Yeah, we did.
The email.
That was denied. The NRA wants to make sure that people that have served time in mental institutions get their gun rights back.
Yeah, that's a great idea.
And they want to let people bring guns into bars, you know?
I mean, can you imagine... Hey, a little fist fight?
Yeah. And
fine.
I'm sorry you're tired about it, Patrick. Go watch some sports. Here's Fred in Detroit. Oh. Fred, hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. I'm not sure what to say, huh?
Well, I was just going to say that last guy forgot that David Koresh opened up at the very outset of that standoff and shot four agents. So.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that little thing. Yeah, thank you.
So that goes out the window right there.
That little tidbit.
And I was mainly calling to say that, you know, this country is full of scumbags.
Yeah.
The kind of arguments they make over nations like Canada or Europe with socialized medicine. It's kind of the same type of anecdotes. And you notice that you hear about, welfare queens.
Right.
There's one on every corner, one on every bush, even though they are by far the exception rather than the rule. And about, hello?
Yeah, we're listening. Yeah. Oh, okay. We're enjoying what you're saying. Believe
some,
me.
Some people I talk when they're
sometimes
talking.
We don't interrupt people because we like what you're saying.
We like them.
Well, I'm just going to add, too, that a couple of weeks ago, CBS News talked to Europeans about the state of their countries. And, you know, of course, Northern Europe has it pretty damn good. And everybody lives well, and they're well taken care of. And the whole tax thing, all that did was streamline the system. So you don't have a gazillion payers and payees. You pay your taxes, you get the services. And it seems like nobody in this country can understand that.
Yeah,
they don't. And I think I've used the example in the suburb that Jolene and I live in when they're all of a sudden, you know, because of the Republicans giving less money in revenue sharing to the city because our property values have dropped. We're going to have to start doing all these layoffs. So we go to a city council meeting. Jolene wasn't there. I was there. And there were people, you know, politicians and police and people like that, you know, city employees, all who have the best interests of the city in mind. But something's got to go. You know, we don't, the money isn't there. It's like the budget is like $2.5 million short. That's what Michael Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, has in his pocket.
Yeah.
Right? That's pocket change to this guy. And here are people in my city screaming at each other. You're lying. You're wrong. You don't know what you're talking about. You're ruining our city. You know, and in the wealthiest country in the world, where people, where talk about scumbags like the Koch brothers, that just have billions trying to make life, you know, good for the you know, the 1% and bad for the rest of us.
For everybody else.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. All right, Fred, you have a nice evening.
Talk about scumbags.
Yeah.
Woo.
Let me see. We got just, well, you may have heard this. I guess this has been making the round. Mitt Romney's cars will have their own elevator in California.
You know, when I heard this, I thought, I couldn't even wrap my brain around, is this so he has more space?
Well, they have what's called a Phantom Park car lift. It's going to cost $60,000.
$60,000 per, and he's got four cars.
Yeah. And by the way, you know, he this violated
city code.
City code. Thank you. And so he spent more than $20,000 on a lobbyist to help expedite the approval process. In other words,
those lobbyists sure come in handy, don't they?
So think about how many people you know that make $20,000 a year.
Yeah.
And Romney is spending that so he can put his cars in an elevator. Can you imagine? Oh, yeah.
It's a third of one car. That's three of my friend's salaries on one car lift.
Let me see. He includes a car lift for his four on-site cars and 3,600 square feet of underground living space. That's just, oh, yeah. Because,
was that called a basement?
Yeah, well, that's what we do it in our... Says news of Romney's extensive renovation plans is sure to stoke criticism of his personal wealth. Romney has gotten into trouble several times on the campaign trail for inartful statements regarding his personal fortune and the financial struggles of other Americans. He said, I'm not so concerned about the very poor. And Romney didn't do himself any favors when he announced he pays only about 15% in taxes each year, despite having an estimated $250 million in personal
life's
wealth.
Life's good for Mitt Romney.
Yeah. Well...
What?
How about something nice?
Really?
Yeah. That's going to be in the interview.
What do you have?
We have the Grandy Ballroom interview.
Good.
Yeah. So maybe I'll see some of you down there Thursday night at Detroit Institute of Arts.
Right. And I do believe we do not have a show next week.
We don't have it's Easter. They don't let the atheists broadcast on religious holidays. So we get
understand.
Yeah. But we'll Facebook you. And also check us out on Facebook. Facebook.com/nightcall.
Yes.
My website, Peter Werbe, WERBE.com. Good things there. Jolene, thank you so much.
Thank you, Peter.
Sarah? Athena.
And thanks to everyone for calling in tonight.
Yeah, stay tuned for the interviews.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call right after this.
WRIF and WRIF HD1 Detroit.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. You know, it's hard. I've seen it all and done it all. No, I really haven't. But it's rare when something really excites me. And this next guest and what we're going to talk about is truly exciting. It's truly a Motor City story. You know, Bob Seger in his live concert down at Cobo Hall said, Detroit, the home of rock and roll. Indeed. And one of the reasons that it was the home of rock and roll was because of a place, a fabulous place called the Grandee Ballroom. Now, I suspect the audience is probably has different sections. People that were there, people that have heard about it, and probably a couple of you that haven't. Well, this is a brand new documentary just about to have its world premiere here in Detroit. It's called Louder Than Love, and I can introduce it real easily because I'm holding this beautiful poster by Detroit poster artist who did so many Grandee Ballroom posters, Carl Lundgren. And it says, while the rest of the country was grooving to the psychedelic sounds of the West Coast during the Summer of Love, that'd be 1967, Detroit was the epicenter for the raw, gritty, and hard rock and music that changed rock and roll forever. The sound was Louder Than Love. And joining me is Tony D'Annunzio, and he is the man that produced and directed it. He's here in the studio with me. Tony D'Annunzio, welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
And I know you're as excited as I am.
Oh, I'm ecstatic. It's been 4 years of my life working towards this goal. So,
well, I know, and Tony was nice enough to send a screener, as they called it, you know, a preview copy of it, and I did not watch a second of it. I haven't even watched the trailer, which we'll give you the website for, because I want to be sitting there in the Detroit Institute of Arts and see it on the big screen. That's going to be April 5th.
That makes two of us.
The 7 o'clock show sold out. I'm going to be at the 9:30 show. Doug Podell is going to be there as well. We're going to be hanging out. And a beautiful poster in the Grandee style. But I think, I could do this whole of 25 minutes. But
I'm loving listening to you.
I would rather hear Tony D'Annunzio talk about Louder Than Love, the Grandee Ballroom story. And let's just start from the beginning. What gave you the idea to do this in the first place?
Well, my inspiration was that I work here in Detroit in the video production field, and I've been doing it for over 20 years now. At the 20-year mark, I kind of had a decision. I was sitting down with some friends, and we were talking about all the stuff that we've been part of. And looking back on my illustrious career, if you will, I've been able to meet and work with 6 of the last 7 presidents of the United States. I've worked on every major sporting event, from Super Bowls to World Series to NHL hockey Stanley Cup games. And I've met and worked with some of my musical icons throughout those years. I've done commercial with the Rolling Stones and with The Who. And so as we were sitting there talking about all the great stuff that we've done, the conversation turned to, what haven't you done? And that's when it dawned on me that when I got into this business, I'd always wanted to do a documentary that I had produced and directed on my own. And although I love what I'm doing every day, there are some things that you want to do, you know, as a challenge to yourself. So at that point, 4 years ago, I decided I was going to do a documentary that I would produce and direct on my own. So that started the whole process. And I decided when knowing the business as well as I do, I knew that if I was going to do this project, it better be something I love. And so it fell back on two things that got me into the business to begin with was music, and then take a step further was Detroit music.
Well, let's do this, too, just in case. I mean, we forgot about that third group, people who may not have heard of the Grandee Ballroom. And this is about the documentary, Louder Than Love, the Grandee Ballroom story. The Grandee Ballroom was this grand ballroom from what, the 1930s?
Actually, it was built, I believe, in 1929.
Yeah.
And it was built, and it still sits at Grand River and Joy Road, actually right off of Beverly. And it was initially built for ballrooms, for big bands to play. So it was pre-amplification. It was a large, cavernous ballroom with a floating wood floor for dancing and a stage at one end. And another unusual thing about the ballroom is that it was on the second floor as opposed to the ground floor, which would probably make sense nowadays is to make something on the ground floor.
Sure.
So, and it was built by an architect by the name of Charles Agri, who also went on to design the Vanity Ballroom and then what we know as Harpo's, which was the Harper Theater back in the day. So
both also during the 1960s and early 70s were big rock and roll venues. So incredible acts appeared at the Grandy Ballroom. In fact, we could probably fill about 10 or 15 minutes just listing them. Everybody, the greats of classic rock and roll, almost every one of them.
On their first tours.
Yes.
On their first American tours, which is the part that, to me, was mind-blowing. To see the amount of acts that came through there, first American tours, Led Zeppelin, The Who, Pink Floyd, Cream, Fleetwood Mac, keep them going, Peter.
Well, they had house band. The house band was the MC5.
And so let's take it a step back to kind of educate the people. It was built as a ballroom, and it was for a number of years. And after the ballroom kind of, and the part that kind of worked not in its favor, but it was built right before the Depression. So it didn't have the long life that like a ballroom typically would have had as a big, great, big, grandiose ballroom. It slowly was closed down. It turned into a few other places, one being a roller skating rink for a while. For a while, it was a mattress storage area.
Huh.
And so Russ Gibb, local visionary, I'd like to think of.
He was a Dearborn teacher.
Dearborn teacher. He was a DJ back in the day. He had started doing sock hops while he was teaching and found out that he could raise a little bit more money than he did while he was teaching, and was inspired after making some money to head out west and went to San Francisco. And one of his first experiences when he went to San Francisco was going to the Fillmore. Mm-hmm. And that's when the idea came up of bringing California to Detroit.
Complete with a ballroom, complete with incredible posters by people like Gary Grimshaw and Carl Lundgren, who has done the poster for this event. It's the world premiere of Louder Than Love, the Grandy Ballroom story. It's going to be April 5th, Thursday, April 5th, the 7 o'clock show, completely sold out at 9:30 p.m., and then at the Michigan Theater in Ann Arbor on April 9th, and it's going to be in other cities as well, and we'll maybe talk about that later.
Great.
You can go to thegrandyballroomstory.com. There'll also be a link on my site, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. And Tony D'Annunzio, who is the director and the producer, is here in the studio with me talking about it. And we're talking about all these fabulous acts that appeared at the Grandy Ballroom between 1967 and...
I believe it opened in 66, in October of 66. And now if we take it, Russ had went to the San Francisco, was introduced to the Fillmore,
mm-hmm.
thought, what a great idea. Let's see if I could bring this back to Detroit. He comes back to Detroit. He starts looking for a place. He stumbles upon the Grandy, which at that point was abandoned, and then thought this would be the perfect place. It's on a little rougher side of town. It's not exactly in a main area. It's not off of Woodward. It's not off of a place that would typically draw white suburban kids. But his idea was to bring in acts that at this point were original, that were going to play their own music. And that's where he got introduced to, well, actually, this is part of the story where you probably come in, because he went to the Fifth Estate at Wayne State to start talking to Harvey Oshinsky,
right,
to see about how to bring this ballroom, how to bring this idea to Detroit. And you were part of the Fifth Estate, so you're very much part of the story.
And the Fifth Estate still publishing almost after almost 50 years. You go
one
to
of the first underground...
what was called the underground press at the time. It led to the alternative press now, like we, you know, have the Metro Times.
Sure.
And what's the other one? Detroit?
Real Detroit.
Real Detroit, yeah.
Both great.
Yeah, and you got to remember, at that time, there was no alternative. There was the Detroit Free Press, and they didn't news, and they didn't have calendars of events. They didn't announce rock and roll music or poetry or the kind of cultural stuff that we take for granted there. And so Russ Gibb talks to Harvey Oshinsky, who founded the Fifth Estate and still is doing incredible producing and directing.
Oh, you know, Harvey was one of my inspirations for this project. It's a
but,
great man.
And there are so many people that appeared at the Grandy Ballroom. Oh, you know what we should do right now? Let me, because one of the things that happens in listening on the radio is that usually you're, you know, you, where do you listen to the radio? Usually in the car, sure. Right? So people are probably checking out. So we want to keep giving you that URL for that. The GrandyBallroomStory.com and PeterWerby.com is where the information will be. Tony D'Annunzio with me talking about the documentary, Louder Than Love, The Grandy Ballroom Story. Where does that title come from, Louder Than Love? Is that yours? Or
Yes. You know what? Throughout production, I realized that, and just being a movie fan, you need something that's going to give some the audience member something to think about. And the idea actually came to me, if I could tell the story real quickly.
Sure.
I was working with a producer out of New York, and we were talking about, we were going to shoot beauty scenes of Detroit. So this means traveling all over and shooting the iconic shots of Detroit that everyone sees. Well, as we're heading down there, we pass over 8 Mile, and she goes, oh, 8 Mile, that's the Eminem movie. and I said, well, yeah, but you realize that 8 Mile is the dividing line between Detroit and the suburbs. And then it dawned on her that that's what the title, and I'm just thinking that that's what they're referring to is, you know, that this is what this, the title is. So I thought that, in order to have something that was catchy, I came up with Louder Than Love. And my thought behind that is just like the tagline that you read earlier was that, you know, when people think of, 67, they think of the psychedelic sounds of the West Coast, the summer of love. And Detroit wasn't about that in 67. And Detroit was raw. It was gritty. It was hard driving. And so it was louder than love.
Well, I know, as you talked about the Grandy Ballroom that featured all the great rock and roll acts of that era, and I think, I'm trying to remember back, I think to get in it was either $2.50 or $3.50. And when Russ Gibb, who put it all together and was called Uncle Russ, when he had the Cream, which was on its first American tour, as Tony D'Annunzio just said, he raised the price to like $4.50.
Obscene.
People were so upset that they put up a picket line in front of the place denouncing him as a capitalist ripoff artist.
Yeah.
But I was probably in the picket line and then went in. And I remember Jack Bruce's bass almost going through me.
Oh, well, I heard the story where they were nailing Ginger Baker's drum set to the stage,
yeah.
And some of the lighting guys that I interviewed said they watched him do this, and they were laughing to themselves, thinking that who are they trying to kid? You know, what are they doing, doing this? And they said, had he not nailed his drum set down, it would have been in the back of the hall. So, the greatest thing for me about this project was I'm such a music fan that learning all these stories, and over the years I had heard all these legends and myths of the Grandy and all the, you know, the people who played there and what happened that night. And as you could lay, you know, testament to, on any given night you had, or any given weekend, there's three, you know, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, couple shows a night.
Right.
And different bands every weekend, and 1,500 to 2,000 kids at each attendance. So, I was getting overwhelmed by people that wanted to tell their story, their Grandy story of whether they were hanging out with Pete Townsend or, going to have pizza with Jeff Beck. You know, everybody of the age had a story that thought it had to be in this movie, and I felt bad that I had to cut them short. I hope that when people watch this film, this is something that I think it's a story that's long overdue. I'm calling it, and I'm going to take this chance of saying it, that it's the greatest untold story in rock and roll, because Detroit has always been on the forefront of music. But I don't think that it often gets the accolades it should. And I think that this time frame, especially 66 to 72-ish, the bands that were coming out of here were just phenomenal.
They were. I mean, the local bands.
The local bands. Sure. And not just the ones that hit, because, you know, we look back and go MC5 and Iggy Pop and the Stooges and Ted Nugent and Bob Seger and Alice Cooper and Mitch Ryder. But as you listen to the soundtrack of the movie, there were bands that I had to get acquainted with that I hadn't heard before that were Savage Grace, The Up, Third Power, The Rationals.
Frigid Pink.
Frigid Pink is in here. Yeah. Another great band, Wilson Moore Pursuit.
Oh, yeah, right.
Sean Murphy still singing with Bob Seger. A wonderful voice.
Yeah.
Incredible lady with a great voice. Jagged Edge.
Yeah.
You know, so I could see the glimmer in your eye.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah. And you'd see Gary Grimshaw, Carol Lundgren would do a poster every week. And you know, these posters now, the originals, sell for hundreds of dollars.
Yes.
And I'd have them up, my wife and I would have them up on the refrigerator. And she'd say, is this last week's? And we go, oh, yeah, throw it away.
Toss it.
Yeah.
Toss
it. But I'll tell you, and if any collectors out there listening, they're going, oh, no. The reason that they're valuable now is because most people did that, a few wise people. Tony D'Annunzio, I have in my living room, and you may know Lowell Boileau. Do you know him?
Sure.
He's a photographer,
yeah,
he's and
great
he has a great, has a great website here in Detroit. And he has, in fact, I have a photograph of his, a long, wide, I think he did two or three and photoshopped them together. And it's the Grandy Ballroom. And it's being lit by the hole in the ceiling of what it is. Well, okay. We probably took it 5 or 6 years ago. And I think, well, yeah, I used to lean against that pillar.
Yep.
But what? Tell me, when did the Grandy? I don't remember this. When did the Grandy Ballroom close its doors? And when? And what is its condition today? And are there shots of it?
Well, I'm realizing that you didn't watch my trailer at all. I'm getting kind of
upset.
No, I
didn't want to watch it at all.
And you know what? Because what you will see, and I'm very proud of this, and as we get in this conversation, I'd like to point out that although I'm here, this wasn't an army of one to do this project.
Yeah.
Huge accolades to Carl Rausch and Forest Post Productions for putting the edit together and believing me enough to take on this project gratis for me. So,
and you had like 60 hours of interviews.
I had
editing it. It must have been something I couldn't even imagine.
Editing it was amazingly easy because of the people I'm working with. Carl is a creative genius, and he brought my ideas to the screen, and without those guys at Forest Post, this would just be a box of tapes that eventually I would call you, Peter, and say, do you want to come over and watch a raw interview of Ted Nugent?
Mm-hmm.
Because it wouldn't have gotten to where it has gotten to without them. So first of all, I want to thank them for all their credits that they do deserve. But what you'll see in the film is, I have, over 60 hours of, interviews, including, everybody from the usual suspects of, the locals of Russ Gibb, John Sinclair, Lenny Sinclair, Carl Lundgren, Gary Grimshaw. I thought that, obviously you need to touch on the musicians of Detroit. So, it also includes, Scott Morgan, Jem Targell of, Third Power, Wayne Kramer and Dennis Thompson of The Five, Alice Cooper, Ted Nugent. And then I also started tapping into some of the people that were part of the scene that, weren't the musician types. Tom Wright, who was the Who's manager on the first tour, but then became the manager at the Grandy. I started to step outside of Detroit thinking that in order for this story to be told correctly, we needed people that their careers were affected by the Grandy. And as you'll see in the film, the Who's love of Detroit and love of Michigan in general started pretty much with the Grandy Ballroom and their acceptance there from a crowd that wasn't – the crowd in Detroit knew the Who before they stepped on the stage, and that didn't happen for the Who in other cities. And I think because of that, because of stuff like that, it encourages the musicians to go on. I mean, I'm not saying they would have faltered, but they've come back and they've given back to Detroit with their concerts and their funds to Gleaners and stuff. So,
and in Louder Than Love, the Grandy Ballroom mm-hmm. story, you have an interview by Roger Daltrey.
Roger Daltrey was gracious enough to give us an interview. So, Roger Daltrey's in the film. B.B. King, we sat with him for a time being backstage after one of his shows, and he talked about Detroit music and that era and the Grandy and how those clubs, the Grandy, the Fillmore, helped rejuvenate his career as a kind of a crossover club for the African American artists. Because not only rock and roll was at the Grandy, the bill on any given night could have been Sun Ra, yeah. James Cotton, and the MC5. So these were pre-Lollapalooza type shows that had different genres of people. I mean, you know, I'm looking at some of these posters from back in the day with Parliament Funkadelic, with Iggy and the Stooges, and The Who as, you know, on one bill.
And I'm trying to remember The Doors and...
Well, you know what? That was one of, there was a few acts that I found out that, although the legends had it that they played there, The Doors never played at the Grandy.
Isn't there a Doors concert?
That's at Cobo. That was the Doors at Cobo, which was a Russ Gibb Presents.
Okay.
Yeah, which was a Russ Gibb Presents production, because Russ, after getting the Grandy going, with the help of, you know, and from what I learned in the interviews was that people like Wayne Kramer and Dennis Thompson and John Sinclair were helping Russ to find out people to play there. So you would have Howlin' Wolf, you'd have John Lee Hooker, you'd have B.B. King.
This is incredible.
James Cotton, you know, then you take it a step further to the English acts that start coming through there with Pink Floyd and The Who and Cream and John Mayall and the Blues Breakers. And, as I talk about the acts that come through there, it sounds like this place has been around for 30 years.
That was my question. How long did it last? Well, I can't remember the closing.
Sure. From 66, from the opening notes of October of 66 to the closing notes in 71, 70, the evening of New Year's Eve of 71, 72. And as John Sinclair says in the film, the MC5 being coterminous with the building, they played the opening night, they played the closing night.
And why did it close?
At this point, people started realizing that the acts could, there was acts that could start making more money other places. Venues started opening up. The East Town started opening up. The Michigan Palace started opening up. Other people started booking acts like this. You know, this was the infancy of rock and roll as we know it. What Russ did, which was, you know, just amazing, was at this point in 66, you had East Coast and West Coast. And so what he was telling some of the artists and the management, saying, why don't you stop in Detroit? You can make a few bucks here and then go on to L.A. or wherever you're going to next. And at that point, you could do that with your plane tickets or with your bus tickets or right. however these people. And they weren't these mega tours that were, you know, as you'll see in the film, one of the MC, the Grandy announcers, the MC of the Grandy was Dave Miller. And Dave Miller was the voice of the Grandy. He brought them on stage. But not only did he bring them on stage, he also had some of these people stay at his house. So when the Cream would come into town, they would stay at his house. And what you'll see in the film is the Cream, Dave provided me with home movies of Cream, of Eric Clapton and Ginger Baker at his house.
Tony D'Annunzio, we could just keep talking about it. I could, and, but that's why I did the film. And I'm sorry, you know, you said, oh, I'm kind of disappointed you didn't watch even the trailer.
No, I'm just teasing.
I didn't want to see, you know, I just interviewed somebody, a book called Detroit, a Biography by Scott Martel. I never read a word of it.
Oh, okay. Okay. Sure. No, I was just teasing.
It's okay. But listen, we've only got about 2 minutes left, and so we're talking about the documentary, Louder Than Love, the Grandy Ballroom Story, this fabulous ballroom that existed for about 5 years in Detroit. Anybody who was anybody in local rock and roll, and that was somebody, and these incredible national acts are all there. It's contained in this documentary, Louder Than Love, the Grandy Ballroom Story. You can go to the grandyballroomstory.com. So we have about 90 seconds. What should we tell them? We should tell them that Thursday, April 5th, 9:30, still tickets available, Detroit yes. Institute of Arts. You go to DIA.org, I believe, or yes. you can go. Can you get them through the
Grandy? You can get them through the website. What we're doing is April 5th show at 7. All the money and the proceeds from the sold-out show are going directly to the Cass Community Food Services. We're giving back to the community just like a lot of other people here in Detroit are doing. We have the 7 and the 9:30 show. Then we also have a showing at the Michigan Theater on April 9th. Proceeds from that show, it's actually Martin Van Dyke's moving picture, film series. Proceeds from that will go to help Scott Morgan and, his health issues right now. From there, We take it on the road. The reason why I made this film was to start getting into film festivals. I've been accepted into the Chicago Music and Movie Festival, and that's April 12th to the 15th. And then the following weekend in Nashville, April 19th to the 26th. And then after that, I've been invited by the president of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, Terry Stewart, to have a screening at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland on May 16th. So I'm very excited about what's going on this next month. I can't thank you enough for allowing me to be on your program. I'm a big-time fan of yours.
Well, Tony D'Annunzio, the thanks is all mine, and I think to anybody that loves rock and roll, which is everybody listening to this station. So one more time, we're looking at Thursday, April 5th, 9:30, Detroit Institute of Arts, and then in Ann Arbor at the Michigan Theater on April 9th. The GrandyBallroomStory.com. There'll be links on my site, Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. And if you go down the left column in that, you can see all these concert posters and kind of the stuff we've been talking about. So, hey, I'll see you all at the Grandy on Thursday night. Yeah?
Oh, one last thing. There will be a pre-screening reception at the Majestic Theater starting at 5 p.m. on April 5th. That will allow people to come back into the city, enjoy Detroit as we know it, have something to eat. I'll be there to meet and mingle with people. We'll have photos from Lenny Sinclair, posters from Carl Ludgren and Gary Grimshaw, and I'll be on hand before the DIA showing. I'd love for people to come down and enjoy the great atmosphere at the Majestic.
Tony D'Annunzio, thank you.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this. We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Detroit's in trouble. Lots of cities in trouble. A lot of the suburbs around Detroit. Financial trouble. And kind of hard to figure out. Well, people have lots of, explanation. It's those darn public workers. It's just the economy. It's a 100 different things. But we see this happening all around the country. But Detroit's a pretty special deal. For one thing, it's our city. And, all of this didn't just happen today or a week ago or even 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. And it's always good to get an idea of where we came from and what caused all this by understanding history. Well, a wonderful book has come my way. It's called Detroit, A Biography. And the author is Scott Martell. He's also the author of The Fear Within and Blood Passion. He's a veteran journalist and a former staff writer for the Detroit News, where I knew him, and also worked for the Los Angeles Times. His work has appeared in the Washington Post, Sierra Magazine, lots of other places as well. We find him now at his desk in Irvine, California. Scott Martell, welcome home.
Hi, Peter. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, Detroit, A Biography. I mean, you must share my sense that I just put out there that that we just didn't pop out of nowhere in terms of what Detroit is today, but it goes way back.
Yeah, it does. And that was one of the things that led me, fueled my interest in doing this book. I've lived outside of Detroit for 15 years now, and it never ceases to amaze me how little most Americans actually know about the city, both what it is today and how it got to be where it is today.
Well, and how does one go about doing a biography of a city? Did you do it from your desk in where we find you now at Irvine, California, or did you revisit the Motor City?
Both cases, actually. For the early history stuff, I was able to do a lot of that remotely from here. Books are books, and as long as you pick them up, you're fine. But I also made a couple of research trips to Detroit. I spent, I think, 7 weeks altogether doing stuff there. The book is, a historical dive into archives at the Detroit Public Library and other places. But it's also, I have some stories of contemporary Detroiters to sort of put some of these issues into context. And for those, you obviously had to be in Detroit and spend time with these people.
Well, I would suspect if people had any idea of Detroit history, a lot of people don't have any, but people would know, well, a guy named Cadillac came here, and and then there was Fort Pontchartrain and Chief Pontiac, and then there was the labor movement in the 1930s, skipped a few years then, right? And then there were the riots, and all the white people left, and now it's all gone to hell.
For most people, Detroit's history is pretty much, tail fins in the 50s, Motown, and, the collapse.
So, yeah, and that's the Motown, the kind of the glamour you don't really address.
No, what I tried to do in this is to focus in on the socioeconomic stuff. The Motown history is fantastic, but it's sort of a thin slice of it. And I think when people start really kind of narrowing their vision into these cultural moments in the city's history, they miss the big picture stuff. And that's really what we need to focus on, to figure out what's happened to the city and how to get out of this situation.
Well, Scott Martell, in your book, Detroit, A Biography, it's about close to 300 pages. I mean, obviously, you could have written 3,000 pages, right? I mean, you could probably about almost anything. What are the highlights? In other words, some stuff had to be missed. What are the signal events as you see them in your book?
Well, what I tried to do is just that, focus in on kind of the critical junctures, the things that jumped out at me as moments where Detroit's future was kind of set. But to do that, you had to understand the full background of the city. So it starts with Cadillac, putting that first canoe in the riverbank in 1701, I think it was. And he has this great description that he sent back to Paris about, the meadow that they encountered and the wild bear and deer and all this stuff, fruit trees just filled with fruit. And from that era, though, all this really left are street names and that original layout of the city, the old ribbon farm streets. So I, in the early chapters, I sort of deal with that pretty quickly and then move into the economic development, which kind of began with the opening of the Erie Canal that made Detroit a hub on the Great Lakes and a hub for lumber and all that sorts of thing. And from there, just into the big issues like the 20s, The birth of the auto industry, the growth of the auto industry, the Great Migration from the South in the 20s, the Depression, World War II, Arsenal Democracy, then into the housing crises of the 40s and 50s, and then on into the modern era.
Well, Detroit's over 300 years old, and yet if you really looked at most of the architecture, the remaining buildings, you would think, well, gee, it must have been created at about in the 1860s to the 80s, if you're lucky if you find any buildings from that era. I mean, there was a big fire here. When was it, 1803?
Yeah, that was very early. That's when the Grand Circus Park layout, you know, that spoke and right. wheel kind of layout, that's where that came in. Woodward was the guy who designed that, and he stole the idea from L'Enfant, who was laying out Washington, D.C. at the time.
What I'm getting at, I guess I didn't ask the question fully, is what happened to, you know, you go to Boston and you find stuff from the 18th century. You go to, you know, you go to Europe and you find stuff from the 15th century, the 14th century that some of even still occupied. Where's all our buildings? How come we don't have any sense of the longevity of the city the way even people do in Boston?
Well, they all got bulldozed 100 years ago or so. You know, the original city was primarily wood structures, and then they moved into some brick-and-mortar structures. But they really weren't built to last at that point, or the ones that were built to last. People, you know, they buy the property and put something else in it. Usually, you know, they replace a mansion with an office building. And so that you know, old part of the city just disappeared. I think one of the last parts of it that existed was that old Monroe block. Right mm-hmm. near the Campus Martius.
Sure.
And that's been, you know, pretty much bulldozed also.
Well, let's do this. I mean, to some extent, it might make sense to go through your book, Detroit, a biography, sequentially in terms of the years. But maybe with the cliche, cut to the chase. If you talk to the people, the white people that have moved to the suburbs, particularly people that are over, say, 50, they're thinking, oh, Detroit was such a nice city, then there was a riot, then Coleman Young got elected, and it all went to hell. And if they don't say it directly, the implication is those are the election of Coleman Young and the riot in 1967 before, those were the signal events that led to the destruction of Detroit in terms of its former glory. What do you think about that?
Two responses. The first one is people tend to look at a history of a place they know through their own personal prism. So you tend to get that analysis from people who really don't remember Detroit in the 40s and 50s. You know, it tends to be the people who, you know, whose vision of the city was the 60s. It's interesting that the census data shows that Detroit was already undergoing a radical change in the 50s. The peak population was just over 1.84 million in 1950. By 1960, it had dropped down to 1.7 million. So there was already some erosion underway. But what's most significant about that decade of the 50s is while the city lost 180,000 people in population, it lost 363,000 white people and picked up 182,000 black people. So that change was already underway in the 50s. In fact, Detroit lost almost as many white people in the 50s as it lost in the 60s.
And that was just because of the burgeoning suburbs at that time?
It was the white flight. The real signature event wasn't the riots in 67. It was a housing, a legal case before the Supreme Court in 1948 that threw out the deed covenants. I don't know if you remember those, but for decades, it was legal for a property owner to have on his property a restriction on who it could be sold to, but barred selling the property, houses usually, to black families.
Usually they would say white Christian buyers only.
Right. Yeah. Various shades of that, yeah. And then in 1948, there was a case out of Detroit. There was the McGee family and also out of St. Louis. They merged the cases. And until then, the Supreme Court had held that a deed was a private contract between individuals, and thus if they want to put a restriction out like that, they were perfectly allowed to do that. But Thurgood Marshall was working for the NAACP at the time. And he came up with the argument that, okay, fine, if it's a private contract, it's a private contract. But if the government enforces this contract, then the government is denying due process to blacks, and thus it's unconstitutional. And that argument carried the day in 1948. So beginning in 49-50, middle-class blacks especially began moving out of Black Bottom and neighborhoods like that into the white neighborhoods. And the response by the whites was to move further out into the newer neighborhoods that were being built, like in far northwest Detroit. And as the 50s moved on and more blacks were moving out, the whites began moving even further out into the new suburbs. And you know, then you have that whole white flight scenario that we're all quite so familiar with. But that was well underway before the riots. In fact, the riots just kind of accelerated the things that were already happening.
And the racial tension, as you mentioned in your book, Detroit, a biography, Scott Martell, is that didn't begin, certainly not in 1967, certainly not with the election of Coleman Young. But you talk about it going back as far as the Civil War. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, bad relations between whites and blacks, unfortunately, is the national curse. It's been going on, you know, forever. And in Detroit, there were riots in the 1860s. But the bigger thing, you know, the more contemporary impact of it is the housing issue. And that really began to exacerbate it's become exacerbated at the end of World War II, when young white males were coming back from the war. You know, most of them lived with their parents or in family homes before the war. They came back after the war, GI Bill money, you know, wanted to start families, wanted to have homes. So it created a huge housing crisis. And the city just was not ready for dealing with that. One you mentioned before, you know, the big moments in Detroit history. One of them that jumps out at me was the 1949 race for mayor. That was between Albert Cobo of Cobo Hall fame and a guy named George Edwards, who was the city council president at the time. Edwards was one of the early guys from the UAW who was involved in the Kelsey Hayes strike, all those big early moments, and had huge labor support and huge support in the city among, you know, rank-and-file people and workers. But he got beat in that election. And I found these great notes in the Ruther Library from some of the people who were his kind of street workers during the election. Doug Frazier was one of them. And they had this kind of debriefing afterwards and says, you know, well, what happened here? And what it came down to is this great anecdote where one of them had encountered a shop steward in one of the auto plants who was handing out pro-Cobo pamphlets. And the person says, what are you doing? Edwards is our guy. And the response was, we're with the union in the factories, not in our neighborhoods.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, there was this huge movement of, and I can't remember the exact name, but it was called the something or other homeowners movement that has been,
right,
that has been said was a larger social movement than even the union movements of the 1930s. And it was to stop any kind of integration.
And yeah, and that was what was behind the Sojourner Truth riots, which was in, I forget the year exactly, it was in the 40s.
Yeah, and also there was a big, and properly said, a big race riot in Detroit in 1943. And very frequently, am I correct, that up until the 1967 riot, that most of these were anti-black riots initiated by whites?
Yeah, the one in 43 was a true race riot. You know, some of the more modern era ones, including Detroit and later in Los Angeles, are more like civil insurrections, you know, civil uprisings. But 43 was just a flat out race riot. And it began with a fist fight in an amusement park out on the east side of Detroit. I'm blanking on the name, out near Harper Woods. And then the next night or the night after that, some of the same players were down at Belle Isle. And a fistfight broke out down there, and it drew in some sailors who apparently were home on leave. And it became, you know, sort of a sprawling brawl, black on white. It moved across the MacArthur Bridge, and there were some bars and nightclubs down in that area at the time. And, you know, they sort of got caught up in it, and then it just spread across the city. And what propelled it were two rumors. One was among blacks that a black woman and her baby had been thrown off the bridge by the whites. And the other one, I think, was the rape or the murder of a white woman by a black mob. And those two rumors were, you know, just jetting around through the white and black communities. And all these pent-up frustrations just came to a head, and, you know, bedlam ensued.
Including from the tension from the war. My guest is Scott Martell. If you'd like to go to his websites, one place you can hook on to his book, Detroit, a Biography. It's Scott Martell, ScottMartelle.com. And it'll also be a link on my page, Peter Werbe, Werbe.com. And there'll be also on our Facebook page as well. Well, it's pretty bleak. I mean, history. history, when you look at it, doesn't do much with just people sitting in their neighborhood sharing, a barbecue of, picnic lunch and all that. So it very often is these bleak incidents. Is there a heroic period at all in Detroit, or is it just all, not real pleasant history?
Well, the rise of the auto industry was a pretty fascinating era. I don't go into that in much detail in my book because there's so many great books out there about that. But the building of Detroit and what it became is pretty interesting history. But even then, there were body counts involved. That was the origins of the union movement, the UAW. It was the Ford Hunger March in 1932, in which four people were killed that morning, a fifth one died later. And all they were trying to do was to get Henry Ford to pitch in some money and help. So even in the bright moments, there are bad moments.
Yeah, well, indeed. But it's interesting. I wonder. Do you think that's true with every city? I mean, is Detroit particular? I mean, is Detroit cursed? I mean, that's an odd question. I realize, but is this just social history and the way it is? And is Detroit unique, or do you think it has that kind of? All big cities have that kind of history.
Well, a little bit of both. All big cities have this kind of history. As we saw, there were riots all over the place in the 60s. But where Detroit is unique is that it is such a singular industry town. So when things get very tough in the auto industry and the heavy industry, there's no other part of the economy that can really soak up, that slack. Mm-hmm. So somebody was asking me the other day about Chicago and, how is Detroit different from Chicago? So Chicago got beyond the stockyards. It became a economically diverse city. And Detroit never really diversified. Ironically, it was very diverse before the auto industry rose. In the late 1800s into like 1910 or so, Detroit was one of the leading manufacturing sites in the country for metal stoves, for wheels on railroad cars, for drugs. Parke Davis, was a huge drug producer back then. Pharmaceuticals, and it just goes on. It was the largest maker of shoes outside of New England in the 1880s and 1890s. But once the auto industry came along, it just dominated everything. Everybody got so rich in that auto industry that it just dominated the focus of Detroit's industrial elite. And so within that context of having, no real diversification in the economy, when things get ugly, when the economy goes south, there's nothing there to support people. And that's when all these, more subterranean fractures surface. You tend not to have a lot of street anarchy and riots and that kind of thing when most people have jobs and are comfortable in their lives. When people are frustrated, when they find themselves with no hope or not much hope, that's when they tend to react in violence.
We talk about the deindustrialization of Detroit beginning, people put it at different dates, but it really began pretty early, didn't it, when the big three started moving some of these supplier shops and plants to the south, to the American south.
That also began in post-war, mostly in the 50s, and it was a two-pronged thing. One is the big three wanted to get their assembly lines scattered around the country so that the cars were closer to the markets. That's when they began opening up in the South and out here in California. They also were trying to get away from the UAW. They saw labor as, one of the biggest hurdles to their profits. So they're trying to, decentralize, to get closer to markets and to get further away from the UAW.
This is easy for me to say, but it seems that given the strength of the UAW at that time, the first shop, the first union shop, first UAW shop that said, okay, we're moving to Alabama, Walter Reuther should have said, hey, we're calling a general strike in auto. One shop goes south and we're bringing it all down, crashing down. Because once it began, first it began going to Alabama and Georgia and places like that and some to California. And then, hey, how about Mexico? Places like that. But, that's probably easy to say with hindsight. I don't know if any of them could have foreseen what would have eventually occurred.
Yeah, and I'm not as versed in the UAW history as I probably should be, but my understanding is that in the 50s and 60s, the UAW, the big three was trying to get away from the UAW, but didn't succeed very well. The UAW was able to organize those plants.
In the South?
I could be wrong.
I'm not sure.
Expertise. Yeah. I know they had trouble because of the right to work laws.
Well, yeah, that's
yeah,
which is called in the union movement the right to scab. In other words, to not pay dues and still get represented by the union. Well, yeah,
very horrible laws.
So one of the things, and I see this in the suburb that I live in, when you have the tax base reduced, in case now, of course, it's housing prices are dropping or housing values are dropping, and then the taxation linked to it means less taxes, and you wind up with the jobs, rather than being high paying union jobs and union jobs leading the pricing of labor, even among non-union people, you wind up with a city. Well, you know, first it just looks like tis Detroit, but then we have Flint and Benton Harbor and Pontiac. So and some of the other suburbs around as well. Yet we have this enormous wealth in this country. Something is wrong here. Do you address that at all, or particularly in terms of Detroit?
Not the inequality of it, which I sort of take as a given. There are things that can be done. But to go back to your point about property taxes, this is really kind of interesting. In 2001, City of Detroit took in $341 million in income tax in 2001. Last year, it took in $228 million.
Wow. Wait a minute. That's five times more. Or my math run. Wait.
it dropped from 341 million to 228.
Okay, good. As soon as you say figures, I get this gauze goes over my brain. But yeah, it's dropping. I mean, there's what's the unemployment look here like here? It's incredible. Well, it was almost 30% in July of 2009.
Right, and that was the official rate, which as we know undercounts.
Yeah,
I think Detroit's probably more like in the 40-50% range.
And then you have, I remember I just saw recently that almost 40%, I think it was up in the upper 30s, of Detroit, or almost half of Detroit's children were living below the federal poverty line. And I said, these are children. These are little kids, little babies, right, little three-year-olds. And this was either in the Detroit News, where Scott Martell, you worked, or in the Detroit Free Press. And then, and you never should do this unless you want to ruin your day, you go below and read the comments, and they were without an iota of compassion. In fact, so close to, racist remarks and why didn't their parents get a job and all of this? And I'm thinking, wow, this is, it's like the internet has allowed these beastly opinions a forum, because there's not much place you could say that anywhere else, whereas people just say the damned meanest things on the internet. But that's probably another question.
I refer to that in my book. A friend of mine, when the census data came out in 2011, I think the numbers came out, a friend on Facebook had posted something about the city having this population shrinkage. And his friends, he lives in suburban Detroit, his friends just started throwing all this vicious stuff in comments. It's their city, they wanted a city, now they get it, this is their own problems, which is just a horrendous misreading of the historical arc of what's happened to Detroit.
Well, Scott Martell, we're getting close to the end, talking about your book, Detroit, a biography. I haven't said yet, it's printed by the Chicago Review Press, and I'll give your website again in just a minute or two. Do you address solutions? I mean, to me, they're sort of rooted in the economic inequality, and I don't think anybody is really talking about that. I mean, we live in the wealthiest country in the world, and we have school districts and cities going bankrupt and cutting back in services and cutting people's wages, eliminating their pension. Something's wrong here.
Well, I agree. I don't go into much in the way of solutions in the book, because I thought the most important role I could play with this book is helping to define what happened. And from that, you can begin to look at solutions. You look at the city's current fiscal crisis. That's a problem now, but that's a problem that's been 20, 30, 40 years in the making. So I was trying to just sort of drill down and tell how that got to be.
Yeah, and I just wonder what people feel when they talk in racial terms of City of Detroit or Flint or Pontiac, and then look at the same set of circumstances occurring to so-called white suburbs. So I don't know at what point that people are going to look elsewhere. I mean, I think as long as you're looking through a lens of race, that people will never figure anything out.
I agree. Until they crack that nut of racism, you know, there really isn't much room for moving forward.
And we don't have any more room to look at this fascinating book, and that's why people write books, not so we can talk about them. This is to just give you a little appetizer. It's a terrific book. It's called Detroit, a biography, and the author has been my guest, Scott Martell. If you go to his website, Scott Martell, it's scottmartelle.com. You can find out all the information about the book, how to order it, and all that. If you go to my website, Peter Werbe, werbe.com, you also will find the information, the link to Scott's site, and also to a Facebook link as well. Scott Martell, thanks for joining us again in Detroit, where you spent so many years. Fascinating book, and I hope people get a lot of people get a look at it.
Thank you, Peter. I appreciate the time and the interest.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Come on! Let's go!
Back to the rock. Right now.
101 WRIF.
Everything that rocks.